Okay.
Good morning, members. Is this on?
Yeah.
Hello back there. We love that you're all here. We love that you're all here, but we're starting. Good morning. Members, we are going to do two tax bills today, and the goal of both of them is to get our tax system as much as we can with limited resources into federal conformity. This is sort of a redo of last year when Representative Wolfhager carried the federal conformity bill on the House floor the first 8 to 10 days of session because the Minnesota tax system is not in conformity. Due to the vetoed tax bills, and remember there were two vetoed tax bills that had conformity, we are not in conformity once again. And so we now have a kind of a double crisis this year because we didn't come into session until February 12th, and so we are more concerned than ever that we have to get this information to tax preparers and to the Department of Revenue so Minnesotans can receive the tax relief that is coming to them via Congress, and if we don't conform, it's not coming. So basically these two bills are coming early now because the part that's of essence is federal conformity. Kind of all the other bills are, you know, they're nice, but they're not urgent. So we've got two bills here today. One does conformity. Straight up, gets it done, and we can have Minnesotans file their taxes correctly this year. And with some pieces of conformity we're not able to include because they're too expensive. The second bill does conformity and adds a lot of member bills that made it all the way through the tax committee, all the way through the tax conference committee process, all the way to the governor's desk, but were vetoed not because of their content, but because of other issues in the tax bill. So we've kind of got both options here. We're going to try to pass them both if we can. Representative Solberg is going to hear them, and then they're off to the floor. So really the kind of core way to think about what we're doing here today is if we don't do federal conformity and kind of get it to the governor's desk by maybe March 1st, it's probably not going to happen this year. We're going to not be in conformity. We're already late on many provisions. So the other things are extraneous and they're nice, but they are not time sensitive. So this committee can do pass either straight conformity or pass conformity with member bills that weren't controversial. And then the leaders, Speaker Kelleher and Senate Majority Leader Poldemiller and Governor Plenty can decide which approach they'd like to take. But my goal today is to get federal conformity done, and the clock has been ticking for a long time. Commissioner Innes is with us, and he as well is a supporter of conformity, and he will be talking to us in a little bit about the urgency of getting this done. So with that, we want to do the first bill first, which is just straight conformity. We have to adjourn a little earlier today. I know a lot of people have things going, and we're going to come back at 6 o'clock if we can't get through both. My guess is we can't get through both. But we can't delay this past today. We're already late because we've got to get through Ways and Means to the floor and, you know, concur on the bills and then to the governor's office and get this all done, and it's just a few days here. So we're going to have Mr. Michael introduce, or I'll move House File 3201, and we're going to have Mr. Michael walk through the amendments. Is there one for this bill?
Yeah.
Yes, there is. Okay. But before that, Representative Folbert, did you have a question?
Madam Chair, we'll accommodate you as much as we can. And Ways and Means, we do have a Ways and Means tomorrow. I don't know if this bill will get reported in time for tomorrow's meeting or not, but
okay.
Otherwise we're planning to tentatively right now something for Monday morning for Ways and Means. There's a tentative one.
Okay.
And if that works in your schedule, if it doesn't work, let me know.
Okay, and thank you for that. So again, it's, you know, the main teaser today is conforming. And that is the time-sensitive portion of why we're trying to get this done right at the beginning of session here. I do want to thank all the people who have been working on this, and this is mostly a staff, technical, labor, and time-intensive set of issues. And it's really been the nonpartisan staff, the partisan staff in both bodies and the Department of Revenue who've been working through these federal conformity pieces. And so Mr. Michael and Ms. Nancy will be able to go through all the detail of all the conformity if we want it. As members know, that's literally probably 100 pages of detail, and we probably don't have that kind of time, but everything's in front of us, so we can, we'll just begin with Mr. Michael's walkthrough first.
Madam Chair.
Who's saying that? Representative Lane.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You said 3201. Did you mean 3200, did you not?
Right.
You're right, I'm sorry. I withdraw my motion and I'll move House File 30, the small one.
3200.
3200. Thank you, I apologize for that. Thank you, Representative Lanning. Representative Broad, you had a question before we started?
Sorry, I was making the same point.
Okay, I'm sorry. Thank you for that. Mr. Michael.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, just, there is an amendment, an A1 amendment, and that corrects a date error in the effective date for the update for the property tax refund, just so that we don't make that retroactive. We don't want people modifying their filing amended property tax refund returns, and really, it really doesn't have any substantive effect because of the way the property tax refund definition of income is calculated. So,
and so I'll move,
that's what the amendment does.
Okay, thank you. I'll move 83200A1. Discussion to the amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say nay. The amendment is adopted. Mr. Michael.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'll try to relatively briefly go through this. There are two things that are different about this than the federal, well, I guess there's three things that are different about this than the federal conformity that the committee passed back during the 2007 session. The first of those things to point out is that since you adjourned, Congress has passed more tax bills, a couple more tax bills, and so this update extends, and some of those tax bills relate back to tax year 07, and so this update provision extends through and includes those additional congressional actions. And just to highlight those, the one is the Mortgage Forgiveness Act, I think is the name of it, and essentially what it did was to provide an exemption for what's called discharge of indebtedness income for individuals who go through mortgage foreclosure, and as a result of that mortgage foreclosure, part of the debt that they owe to the mortgagee has been canceled. Under normal income tax principles, that would be considered to be income to them that's taxable. Congress enacted a law that, starting for 2007, exempts that income from taxation, and this conforms Minnesota law to that change. The second major piece of legislation that Congress passed is what's the economic stimulus bill that the President just signed about a week ago, and that also is adopted in this provision. Now the thing, most of that does not affect, the payment of the rebates does not affect Minnesota tax liability because that's a rebate of federal tax in most cases, or it's just a payment for people that actually don't have federal income tax liability in some, for some low income filers. So that part of it's not crucial, although I guess this confirms that the same principles with regard to the taxability of those rebates for the individuals that receive rebates in excess of their federal tax liability will govern for state purposes as for federal purposes. But two other elements of that federal legislation were business tax incentives. What's called the Section 179 expensing rules were expanded, and bonus depreciation was allowed to businesses. And what House File 3200 does is to say that in our treatment of Section 179 and bonus depreciation, we're going to follow the same pattern that we followed in the past. There was bonus depreciation under the last time we had a recession in 2001-2002, Congress enacted bonus depreciation. We're following the same principle there, which is we're not conforming to bonus depreciation. That would cost like $150 million in temporarily lost tax revenue, which, given our budget situation, is obviously not sort of the same as it was back in 2003. So what's required is the businesses would add back that bonus depreciation and then claim it over the following 5-year period, and that's the same way we treat Section 179. So that's the first thing to keep in mind, is that's the difference from the bill that you passed back in the 2007 legislative session. The second difference is that in 2007 you conformed on all of the individual provisions, including the tuition tax deduction and the teacher expense deduction. Both of those, the teacher expense deduction is not a huge money item, it's $1 million, but the tuition tax deduction is a substantial amount. It's like $18 million or $19 million in revenue. And given the budget situation, the concern was that that was not revenue, that was not a tax cut essentially, that the state that the budget could endure. So what the bill does is it requires that deduction to be added back. Now that, even though that requires the deduction to be added back, that's a big simplification, because both of those deductions are essentially above the line federal deductions, and they affect adjusted gross income. And for those of you who are familiar with sort of the income tax mechanics, when your adjusted gross income changes, that has a host of secondary effects in the tax system, and it affects, for example, the allowance of your itemized deductions. So the floors for purposes of the business expense deduction, the 2% floor, the floor on the medical expense deduction, all of those things need to be recalculated. Similarly with the phase-out of itemized deductions, the phase-out of exemptions. So by conforming with an add-back, you eliminate the complexity of all of those recomputations that would otherwise be required to be done on the M1 NC form. So even though we're not conforming on it, there's a simplicity advantage to conforming on the AGI element of it and then having an add-back. But that's the second difference from the provision that was enacted, that was passed by this committee back in the 2007 session. The third difference is how we offset the revenue loss that would occur. And there are a couple of provisions. And first of all, there's the deferred compensation for individuals who earn income in Minnesota and then move out of state before they receive that. That was in the bill that was passed in 2007, and it's also in this bill. The contractor withholding provisions in this bill that was in the 2007 bill. The new provision, though, is a change in the way we do indexing for 2 years to offset about $4.3 million in revenue loss, and I will explain essentially how that adjustment works. Normally, in August of this coming year, the Commissioner of Revenue, based on the federal indexing adjustment, would expand the two tax brackets, the bottom tax bracket and the middle tax bracket, by the amount of inflation in the previous 12-month period. To offset this revenue loss, what the bill does is direct the commissioner to not expand the brackets by as much as normally would occur, so that the net cost of this bill is revenue neutral after taking into account the revenues from the deferred comp and the contractor withholding. That means that the commissioner is going to, if this bill were enacted into law, would expand the tax bracket for tax year 09 by just a little bit less than they otherwise would. That is going to save about, by our estimate, $4.3 million in the current biennium. That means we will collect $4.3 million in more tax. What the bill then says is that for the next tax year, for tax year 2010, the commissioner is directed to expand the brackets by more than what the inflation adjustment would be, so that the additional revenue that would flow in tax year 09 into fiscal 10 and 11 would be essentially given back to the taxpayers, so that there's no revenue gain in the next biennium as a result of that. And then in tax year 2011, indexing would go back and the brackets would be just as if none of this had happened. So that's the way that sort of complicated mechanism is designed, so that this bill is revenue neutral and doesn't lose $4.3 million in the current biennium. Now, I suspect that may have confused some people, and there may be some questions, but essentially that's what the bill is. And if you want us to go through sort of some of the provisions that we're updating to here, we'd be happy to do that. Some of the highlights, some of the things that I know that members have talked to me about is, for example, the $3,000 exclusion for public safety, health insurance costs, the changes in the health savings account rules. I know that members have been contacted by taxpayers about that. And the changes in the contribution rules for individual retirement accounts. And there's a whole host of, there are seven different tax bills and a whole lot of different provisions that are involved here.
Mr. Michael, if I may, just to put it in perspective, I think it is important for people to look at the bill summary in the first page to really see what are all these provisions we're conforming to, allowing IRA contributions by members of the military, people working within their IRAs and Roth IRAs, people's pension plans, HSAs, as were mentioned, various charitable contributions. The issue that Mr. Michael talked about, which is Congress's move to assist people who are going into foreclosure and to pass that relief on. Many of us have heard from the retired police officers who are supporting provisions in here. We're not getting everything done, as Mr. Michael said, because we just don't have enough money. But I think to put it in perspective, it's taking $4.3 million out of, I believe, a $7 billion income tax stream. So it's like the income tax, I think, raises like $7.2 billion around there. Yep. Ms. Manzi?
$7 billion.
Okay, so that's what we're collecting in income. And it's directing the commissioner to take $4.3 million of that in the bracket adjustment and instead use it to conform. So this is the straight revenue neutral way to do it. I'm putting this out here to get this much conformity done. You could go further and do the tuition deduction and the teacher expensing, Section 179, estate tax, you know, those big chunks that Minnesota has for a number of years not conformed to, although we did the tuition and the teachers last year. But the bracket solution won't work because there's not enough money in it. So there's just very little room in adjusting those brackets to pick up those other pieces. Those are big ticket items that we would get into the full debate on, the big tax increase again. So this was the attempt to use the brackets, and in a one-time way, the Commissioner of Revenue would do that to pull out $4.3 million to conform to as many possible provisions as we can, and that would be a one-time movement by the Commissioner of Revenue, and then it would go back to where we are right now. So that's, you know, there'll be some people who would like that approach and some won't, but I think that's probably the best way to think about it. And if we want to go to questions now, members can, you know, get into the actual details of it or further just broad discussion. Representative DeLaForest.
I'm first, Madam Chair.
Yes.
All right. I really appreciate your willingness to indulge questions. You like this stuff. I appreciate that. And I want to ask this question, because there's Representative Lucavina here this morning as well. Mr. Michael, my question is certainly there's a state numbers aspect to doing the revenue notes and the like. Well, my question is, especially with a lot of monkeying with the depreciation schedules and the like, is there's a theory that it's going to stimulate the economy, and if you take it another step, bring more money into the Treasury. And I'm curious, do you do any modeling that attempts to capture what the additional revenues might be in the out years as a result of stimulating the economy through the kind of accelerated depreciation, other things that we're talking about in some of these bills?
Mr. Michael.
Madam Chair, Representative DeLaForest, these are all pure static estimates. You know, the Department of Finance, when they do the February forecast, to the extent that the federal stimulus bill actually has macroeconomic effects that the state's economic consultant, GII,
will take into account. That'll get factored into that forecast somehow, but that's the only way that would, and that's something that's going to happen no matter what you do here. This is sort of, you know, minor tinkering to keep the tax system simple for taxpayers so that compliance and costs are low.
Thanks. Madam Chair, I just had one more question.
Can I just follow up to yours before that? Just following along what Representative De La Forest is asking, is the streamlined sales tax provision in here? It's not in this one, it's in the next one. Okay, so that would be for the next bill. Are there, though, a flip side of what Representative De La Forest is saying? Because I... Somebody's cell phone? Maybe it's fine. I don't know. I don't have one. I don't know. Okay, so that would be an example in the next bill, but are there provisions also that if not enacted, that revenue is going to have to count, that we've been counting revenue because of them that we lose? And the reason I thought of the sales thing, of the streamlined sales tax, is we actually count money that we get in our forecasting because of that. If we go out of conformity, then we can't count that anymore. Are there provisions like that in this bill? And this also has the congressional tax cuts and the president's tax stimulus plan in it, too. So I think it's a good question, but I don't know how we get numbers around it, Representative De La Forest. Can you think of anything in it that does the opposite effect?
Madam Chair, I don't think explicitly that's the case. Now, a nagging concern that I think a lot of people have who are involved in tax administration is that Minnesota has conformed to the federal system for so long that there are many taxpayers out there that are blithely assuming that we're in conformity. And so they may in fact not, well, and to underline this, the two, and I've told you this before, the two big consumer software preparers have not programmed in, as I understand it, based on conversations I had with the Department of Revenue earlier this month. They have not conformed. They have not programmed into their software the provisions that are necessary to do these non-conformity provisions. So those software packages do not recalculate AGI. Now they have screens that, you know, obliquely, I checked on my own, they obliquely refer you to the Department of Revenue publications that say, gee, you ought to do this by hand. But the nagging concern is that a lot of taxpayers may just be unaware of that and may go ahead and assume that we're in conformity, and so we're not, you know, we're going to suffer some of that revenue loss no matter whether you conform or not. The department thinks that if the legislature quickly passes this bill, because just programming in add back for the tuition and teachers, that those software companies will probably be able, within a relatively short period of time, be able to modify their program to do that. But other than that, it's hard for me to think of whether, if you don't enact this, will you suffer a revenue, you know, some potential revenue loss. That, I think that's the main concern, that some taxpayers will claim these items on the assumption that we're in conformity. Now, we'd probably get that revenue back later because the Department of Revenue, 10 months or 18, I don't know how long it takes them, when they get the federal tapes, they could match and find that people had, in fact, not, you know, had taken these deductions, send them notices, and try to collect the tax and interest that's owed.
Just Michael, excuse me. We have to figure out whose cell phone is on. You need to turn it off. You may have it on vibrate, but it feeds back to the microphone system. So that's what's happening. So everyone, quick look and see if you've got yours, and just kind of power it down. That would be helpful. Representative Colt.
Representative, it'll be my last question for the time being, at least, Madam Chair. My question, maybe it's not even a question to Mr. Michael, but an observation in talking about the add backs and everything else. And I wonder if anybody has made any type of comprehensive effort to capture not only the FTEs at the state level and in government, but in the private sector as well in dealing with all of this. We have to have folks at revenue make up these worksheets that are just an exercise in mental torture to go through. Then apparently, you know, revenue's got to look at the tapes, as Mr. Michael said, and try and find folks who are going to owe some money. And then on top of that, I can only wonder about these very intelligent, talented CPAs out there who spend a lot of time and then charge their clients a lot of money to deal with all this. So I think there's an aspect, a financial and economic aspect, beyond just the raw numbers that we deal with in this committee, and really sort of a hit to the economy, if you will, or even to the state budget, in the sense that we've got folks at revenue who might be better utilized doing something else, trying to work through this Gordian knot we've got of nonconformity.
Completely agreed. And Representative Dela Forest, as you all knows a lot in this area, and it's just kind of a nightmare. We may want to ask the Minnesota Society of CPAs here, I don't know if they want to testify on the bill, but I do think we want to hear from the commissioner or Mr. Manson or someone on this. Other further, first Representative Coles, and then we should hear from the department too as well. Representative Coles.
Madam Chair, for either you or Mr. Michael, are we doing conformity here for taxes payable for 07 or 07 and 08?
07 and permanently on these provisions.
Right.
This is permanent.
So, I know there's been some discussion about what length of time we were going to do.
Yes,
so.
And last year it was just the 1 year. This year we talked about just doing it the 1 year. If we don't at least get to 08, we're right back where we were in the fall. And then the department had done a revenue estimates on permanent or 07, so we don't even know the numbers if you just do 07 and 08. So it's just being done permanently. And after you flow through the economic stimulus package from Congress, the leftover is $4.3 million. If you add those other pieces that were not, then you have to go out and find more money. And, you know, I just made the judgment call that there's just not enough money to flow that through right now. So,
and Madam Chair, I'm glad to hear that. I mean, that's the way to do it. If we're going to do conformity, let's do it, and not do this kind of year-by-year thing that creates not only problems for us and the need to revisit it every single year, which we certainly could do if we have budget issues, but it's a nightmare for taxpayers and tax preparers as well. Mr. Michael, I think next question is for you. Is there any way, I mean, a lot of these items are fairly small items when you get them down to the individual taxpayer level. Is there any way for us can you give me any sense for what an individual taxpayer is looking at for taxes in 2007 in terms of tax relief, if you will, for doing this conformity? And I guess the reason I ask the question is because we're so late in the game, and I still support doing this, but because we're so late in the game, I mean, there are a lot of people who've already filed their returns, and if they want to file an amended return to get a $25 or a $40 or a $60 check from the state, and they don't have the ability or the willingness or the time or whatever to take care of it themselves, and they go pay a preparer to do it, what's the net benefit to a taxpayer who's already filed his or her return? So I don't know if there's any way to give some kind of general idea what taxpayers might actually get if we do this.
And Mr. Michael and Ms. Mandy, maybe piggybacking on that, can you tell us in general about what percentage may have filed by now? Is it roughly about a quarter that we would anticipate by mid-February? Does anybody have maybe the department can tell us when they come down. Okay, Mr. Michael.
Madam Chair, I don't know. A couple of observations about that. In terms of the filing, the department could tell you, but typically the people who file early are the people who have simple returns and would often not be affected by these things. That's sort of one observation. The second observation is that some of these provisions have ongoing implications, and that's one argument for conforming for tax year 07. So as you think about, for example, higher contribution allowances on IRAs or the HSA provisions, those are essentially, if you said, well, you added back, we required you to add back the deductible IRA contribution or the HSA contribution that was made, then to be fair to those taxpayers, we need to allow them to reclaim that sort of capital later. And so if you don't conform for the all years, you get this sort of ongoing headache. some of these provisions, because they're very narrow provisions that affect a small number of taxpayers, don't have a big revenue implication to the state, but they could have a substantial effect on an individual taxpayer. For example, you're allowed to make a transfer from your IRA to a charity and exclude that from income under the federal rules. That can be a transfer of up to $100,000. Similarly, there's a $3,000 exclusion for public safety retirees. You know, and so if you're in about the 7.5 bracket, you know, that's over $200, or, you know, and again, there's the, you know, the headache. So you're right, there may be some taxpayers who filed already and who, you know, may have to file amended returns. I think that's not a large set of people, but the department actually was probably a better one to respond to that.
Representative Coles, that's exactly the reason that you've said to be permanent. And I remember you and Representative Paulson made speeches to that effect when we did the 1 year last year, because you just have this multi-year problem that keeps going. Representative Coles.
Madam Chair, one last question, I guess, for you, and this may not be believed, but I'm not trying to be partisan here. I want to talk about that bracket adjustment. And I think what you said was, you know, this is the straight way to do it, and it's $7 billion, and we're taking 4.3. But how, you know, people on my side of the aisle have been criticized, often rightly so, for budgetary shifts and gimmicks or games or whatever the rhetoric we want to have. How is this not a shift? Now, I think it's, I don't have any problem with it. I support what you're trying to do so we can do some of this conformity, but how is it not a shift?
Well, I personally think it's the next bill that's got the shift. It's not this one. This is the straight one, and the reason it's not a shift, if we weren't trying to raise revenue, then I agree, but this is a straight up, we're trying to get the 4.3, you got to take it out of the system, coming out of the income tax receipts, or out of the income tax, yes, receipts, and you're taking it from there straight. If it was permanently going to be that way, I think you could call it creep, bracket creep, or some shift, but it's not. It's a one-time pulling the 4.3 out of the 7.7 to get to pass on this tax relief all within the income tax system. And so that is the honest place I, in my estimation, deal with it. It's all income tax provisions, all of conformity is income tax, it's taking out the income tax, and it is to get the revenue. I mean, if it were completely no money, then it wouldn't achieve the goal of finding the $4.3 million. So maybe it's semantics, but I think if it were permanent, it would be kind of a shift or a gimmick. It's a one time that is when Mr. Michael first went through it, what happens in 09 and 010, and then it goes back to define $4.3 million over that 2 year period.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I think it probably is semantics. I mean, I think I could argue that's a one time shift. And I support what you're doing, Madam Chair. I'm not, but. You know, my side has at times very rightly been criticized for moving numbers around, and yes, we're talking about a really small piece of the income tax here, but I think there's a senator from U.S. senator from Illinois who's walking around talking a lot these days, running for president, and he's been criticized for
a little nervous, thank you.
He's criticized for just being out there, you know, spewing words. But like Senator Obama, I think words matter, and so, you know, I think language matters, and so I think you know, yeah, maybe it's semantics, but you know, I think it's clear that both sides of the aisle can find a way to accomplish either their own objectives or good public policy. So Madam Chair, again, I support what you're doing here, but you know, I think like Senator Obama, language does matter and words do matter.
And Representative Coles, I don't think that's partisan at all. Bring that up. I hear you. You know, you're absolutely right. It can be talked about that way. It can be called everything from pure to a gimmick. Either way, we're just trying to get into conformity here. I have to thank Mr. Michael and Ms. Manzi for trying to do everything they can to help us in this highly charged environment. You know, first of all, it's a partisan environment, then you got a deficit. And that's why I made the decision to not do some of the big ticket items, because I just didn't see how we could ever get that across the finish line by March 1st. And yet the next tax bill will be to have full conformity in it permanently with a lot more items than this. This is to sort of deal with the tax preparers who are dealing with it right now and try to take out some of the issues that Representative De La Forest talked about, what a nightmare it is, but there'll still be some ones remaining, even if we can get this passed yet this year. So,
thank you, Mayor.
Thank you. Can we hear from the department, Representative Ruth Avina?
Well, Madam Chair, I just want to, maybe because of
And this is for Representative Broad, my newfound progressive on the other side of the aisle. So I'm just wondering about the progressivity of this because, you know, I don't think me or Representative Marquardt or Representative Simpson have very many people that have IRAs or Roth IRAs, much less transfer from them to charities and, you know, some of the other things. And here I see. So I'm wondering, and I noticed there is a little progressivity in the income tax bracket part of it, but then it disappears. So I'm just wondering, given my new partner over here, how progressive this bill is as far as making Minnesota's income tax more progressive and less regressive.
Mr. Michael, you want to take a shot?
Maybe I shouldn't ask this question. I really don't know the answer.
Well, and the economic stimulus federal package is offsetting in here, too. You know, it's flowing down from the federal system and the tax stimulus package, which, you know, wouldn't that be great if we could do what Congress does and the president? We could just give a tax stimulus package and go into deficit to do it. But did the congressional package on net make the federal tax system slightly more progressive, didn't it? I mean, we can't change that, but to get to Representative Brukovina's question, can you guess with
well, all I these... My only concern is we get...
Right.
Then brought the vote for this because he's as concerned as I am all of a sudden about progressivity.
Mr. Michael.
That's a real question.
Okay. Well, I just want to answer. You know, what?
No, this is a real question.
Yeah. I'm chair members of the committee. I'm not aware of any analysis by congressional or treasury staff as to the incidence of these changes. As Representative Rukavina pointed out, some of them obviously disproportionately would be more high-income people.
Right.
On the other hand, you can think about, for example, the mortgage foreclosure forgiveness. That probably tends to be low-income people. Public safety retirees tend to probably be low, middle-income people. So there's a mixed bag, and this is such a small number that it's I would consider it to be basically noise.
Okay. Thank you. And can we get the department to join us too? Representative Broad.
I just have a question for Mr. Michael.
Okay.
And also look forward to working with Representative Rukavina and standing in the way of a massive regressive tax hike tomorrow on the House floor. So I look forward to that with you. But Mr. Michael, I just have a question. I have a question in Section 7 related to how this stock option piece works. I'm trying to understand, you get a stock option, you don't exercise it until you leave the state. How do the mechanics work?
Mr. Michael, whose bill was this last year? This came through the tax committee process and conference committee. Does anyone remember? Because that was the question. This is the Benda case.
Yeah.
I
think it was probably your bill, but I can't remember.
And we had a hearing on it, right? Yes. Do you remember this?
Well, I don't remember the mechanics.
I mean, we get busy. Yeah, walk us through the mechanics again. I mean, this is the people who leave, and then after they made their money here, they don't pay us taxes.
Madam Chair, just to make it clear, first of all, this applies basically, as Representative Broad suggested, to stock options would be one of the biggest categories, and what's called non-qualified deferred compensation. It does not apply to your sort of garden variety 401k type deferred compensation. And the situation would be like this, that you have an employee who's a Minnesota resident who works for a Minnesota company in Minnesota, and as a result of that service performed in Minnesota, gets non-qualified deferred compensation, for example, that's put into a separate account, whether it could be funded or unfunded, or that they accrue stock options as a result that vest while they're working in Minnesota. Subsequently, they change their residence and move to another state. Could be a state with an income tax or without an income tax. You know, they may be transferred back to the headquarters in California or New York, or they may retire to Florida. Before 2000, when this law was passed that was enacted, if they, you know, so it's sort of a simple thing to do is to go back, because we did this for quite a few years. When they actually receive the compensation, so for example, they cash in the stock options after they move back to California to the headquarters for the company. They would normally pay Minnesota tax on that. They would report it as Minnesota income because it was earned in Minnesota for service performed in Minnesota. File a Minnesota return, pay the Minnesota tax. If they're in a state like California or New York, they would also report that income for California purposes and then claim a credit for the tax that they paid to Minnesota. If they've retired to Florida, which has no income tax, then there would obviously be no credit, and they would simply owe the tax to Minnesota. And the Minnesota company that makes these payments, so for example, let's say it's Wells Fargo or it's IBM or 3M or somebody like that, they would treat this just like as if the individual was a Minnesota resident. And so they would, these payments get actually reported typically on W-2s. And so they would withhold presumably Minnesota tax on it. If they failed to do that, then the Department of Revenue would get records from those companies, and they did this back in the 90s, would go and audit them to make sure that they paid the tax that was due. And I think there was actually a modest amount or maybe a heavy amount of auditing activity on this because there is some sort of non-reporting. And again, if the individuals are like a California person, then they would have to file an amended California return to claim the credit as well as pay the Minnesota tax.
Yeah. Just to follow up quickly, how does it relate to partial residencies? If you just move to Florida or retire to Florida part-time, does it affect that at all, or is...
Madam Chair, Representative Broad, if the income was received in a year when you were a part resident, it would affect your liability in that year, and it would affect your factor, because basically for those people, we tax it based on their Minnesota source versus their non-Minnesota source income, and this would be Minnesota source income. So it would go on the numerator of the fraction.
Okay. Thank you. Can we hear from the department? And we do want to try to at least start the next bill if we can. So, Mr. Manson? Thoughts on House File 3200?
Madam Chair, committee members, Jack Manson with the Minnesota Department of Revenue. First, I'd like to thank you for your efforts to try and get an early passage of this bill. Joel covered a lot of the complexities and the different issues that you can actually resolve as part of this bill. And there is even the benefit, even that partial conformity on the bonus or the depreciation, where you do have a modification where you add back 80%. And then take the remainder over 5 years. But that also helps so small taxpayers and sole proprietors don't have to keep like two separate sets of depreciation schedules. When they go to sell an asset, they don't have a difference in basis on gain between Minnesota and federal. So even that partial conformity is a big help. And then also, Representative Vila Forrest made a lot of comments about, is this really the best use of, the department's time trying to develop all these forms and instructions, or the practitioners having to deal with these, the software developers, all those people that are struggling with these modifications as a result of not conforming. So, for instance, we have a six-page form and instructions that we had to develop that will basically go away, which is a good thing, but we did have to design this. It's out there. And then also, even if, people say, well, a lot of people, electronically file, well, I looked at Tax Act, which is one of the developers that actually are doing the M1NC, and some developers aren't, as Joel mentioned as well, but they ask a lot of questions about, your age, your charitable contributions, whether you itemize deductions, you're a shareholder of an S-Corp, you claim tuitions and fees, you own a restaurant, blah, blah, blah. So everyone's got to go through these questions. So it gets even complicated if you're electronically filing as well. As far as how many taxpayers may have already filed, my guess is that maybe about a third of those are probably filed. And as Joe mentioned again, those are probably more of the simple returns that aren't impacted by a lot of these modifications. So it's important, to pass this early. Our hope is by March 1st, right around there, Because once we get into early March, we're about at a million filers by then. So, and I know a lot of that we've been working with the developers, and some have made this M1NC, some haven't. Hopefully they can adjust and pull the schedule down with early passage. Also, we've talked to a lot of the preparers, too, and they're always interested. Is there going to be an early bill? Is there going to... So we're, you know, hopeful. So they've been talking to their clients too and saying, you know, maybe a push to do an early bill, try and hold off so we don't have to file and then amend later. So I know they're very supportive, the society, CPA society, and other practitioners as well. So it is important. It's a help to get this done as early as possible. Representative Coles, he talked about some of the problems with doing it in the middle of the year, and that, I mean, your questions really point out that if we could avoid this in the future, it'd be great, you know, rather than being in the middle of a filing season, but obviously we can't this time around, so. But anyway, it's important. If we get this done, it would be great.
Okay, thank you for that. Appreciate that, and sort of a tedious thing to go through, but I'm glad everyone's realizing the importance of, at least in this room. This is a tax committee, so people have to take this seriously, and it's difficult to get beyond the tax committee members to understand why this is so important, but I'm glad we're at least all on board here so far today. Is there anyone else who would like to testify? Otherwise, we're going to take the vote and get to the next bill. If not, all those in, will renew my motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed say nay. The bill is passed and it's sent off to Ways and Means. And we'll wait and learn from Representative Fulber when he really gets that firmed up. So thank you all for that. And now, Mr. Michael, if you would mind presenting as well with your staff the next bill. And that is House File 3201, and I'll move that now. And I think we have maybe three amendments to get this all together. Yes, please. I guess we have some. I think two amendments might be in our package numbers, and then there's an additional. So just pass any amendments out from that I have, and I think Mr. Michael told me this morning it's a total of three. Is that correct?
Yes.
Three. Okay, so Mr. Michael, which one should we do first?
Madam Chair, I think the A1 amendment is the sort of the largest one that includes the most changes, so maybe you want to do that.
Okay, so I'll move the A1 amendment. And this one's in our packet, I believe.
Yep.
Okay. That's Tommy. Just give it to Tommy. It's time we're convening. It's up to Tommy.
Right.
So, okay, so we're on the A1 amendment. And before you start, Mr. Michael, you know, again, this is a bunch of the last tax bill plus conformity again. Trying to do conformity again. This is sort of two options for the big three. Do they want to conform and do the right thing and get that done, or do they want to conform and pass some of the more non-controversial bills that already went through the process? And so we're sending them both ways. This one had a lot more work from staff because of spreadsheet changes and working through with the Senate, and that's why this amendment is a little more complicated. So if everyone has the A1 amendment, Mr. Michael.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, first thing I'd like to point out is that the bill summary reflects this amendment, which largely is, a large chunk of this is sort of fixing drafting errors and mistakes and omissions and that sort of thing. So the bill summary reflects this amendment. And so as you look through the bill summary, keep that in mind. Just to quickly run through the provisions, maybe as you can see at the top on page one, the first five lines are dates and cross-references that, you know, one of the things that we had to do is we took the vetoed bill and tried to, you know, bring its provisions up to date. You have to adjust all the effective, or some of the effective dates, and these are just some that we missed, to make sure that this is actually workable, enacting a session later. On lines 6 through 8, those 6 through 10 and following, again, those are things that were suggested by the Department of Revenue staff after they reviewed the bill, and we thought they made sense. Toward the bottom, one of the revenue raisers that's in this bill to offset the cost of federal conformity, and we'll talk about it because federal conformity in this bill is paid for in a different way than the previous bill. One of the things is the disallowance of fines, penalties, and those kinds of things that taxpayers pay. When we did that, we had the individual side, but because we deleted all of the corporate provisions, since this doesn't have any of the other corporate changes in this bill, we forgot that we also deleted the corporate provision on that, and so this restores the corporate disallowance.
For clarification, Mr. Michael, so that was because the old veto bill, remember, had the FOC provisions and other corporate provisions. It was referring to those. They're gone, so they had to add this piece back in so that all the FOC stuff is not in here.
The next change, if you look on pages 3 and following, the bill as drafted, pursuant to discussions between Representative Lincheski and Senator Bach, had one year of federal update in it. The amendment starting on page 3 so adopts instead permanent federal update and permanent conformity, which you've had discussions about already. So that's a large part of the amendment. As you get to page 9, you'll see it. The changes on the bottom of 9 and the top of page 10 relate to the June accelerated sales tax. And as the bill was being put together, the sort of the costs were moving around. One of the ways that the conformity is paid for in this bill is by upping the June accelerated sales tax percentage. In the bill as drafted, it went to 81 after we got better revenue numbers from the Department of Revenue. It was clear that we only needed to increase that to 80%, not 81. Now, there's still a little bit of a deficit, which Amendment Number 2 will attempt to address. So that's the reason for that change. I believe the other thing was that the next major change to focus on is on page 11. Because of discussions about what was to be in the minerals article, that the minerals article was deleted from the bill altogether, and one side effect of that was that Representative Nornes's gravel tax provision also got dropped. This adds back the town of Scambler in Otter Tail County, their gravel tax authority, to the bill because that was sort of a side effect of deleting the whole minerals article.
Okay, questions on the amendment? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. The amendment is adopted. And then can we just do the next one then?
Sure.
Yes. Can you confirm for me, or can Mr. Michael confirm, that federal conformity we just that's in here and that we made permanent mirrors what we did in 3200, correct?
Yes, there's no additional provisions, again, not enough money.
Yep, great.
And I should add on the Representative Nornes thing, I didn't talk to him. What happened is Representative Rukavina and Representative Bach, and he'll get into it later, they couldn't work out minerals until, I don't know, late last night, I guess they had dinner and they arm wrestled, and he's going to have an amendment to bring it back, because as you all know, there was a minerals article in the veto tax bill. They were working on some provisions, couldn't agree, so we didn't have a minerals article here today. And Representative Nornes was sort of a side effect of that. He ended up losing his bill, and Mr. Michael found that, and so we're adding that back in now. But Representative Rukavina will be offering an agreed-upon minerals amendment later here, either today or tonight. So just to clarify that. So thanks for that. So the next amendment then would be, did we adopt that?
Yes.
Okay. The next
amendment would be the A3 amendment.
And I'll move the A3 amendment, Mr. Michael.
Madam Chair, this is actually an amendment to the amendment that you just adopted in part, and an amendment to the bill. It has two components. The first one is that with the June accelerated sales percentage set at 80, there's a $200,000 deficit. To make up for that deficit, we're modifying federal conformity to disallow one item for C corporations that donate computer equipment during tax year 2007. This is a one-year federal expense provision. Essentially, what this does is it disallows that those corporate charitable contribution deductions. So this only affects corporate filers. It's for tax year 07, so the equipment's already been donated. It's not going to affect any incentives. And that raises about $300,000, which again results in a positive balance on the bottom line. The second change in this amendment is on the last line, and that changes the provision of the local sales tax moratorium. That's the prohibition on local government spending money for referenda to essentially get new authorizations for sales taxes. Now, all existing authorizations are grandfathered, and we're adding to this grandfather, or if they were authorized by statute, and this relates to the transportation bill, since that bill authorizes some counties outside of the metropolitan area to hold referenda for transportation local sales taxes. And so if both of these bills happen to pass, it was not intended that this prevent them from holding those referenda for local sales taxes, and so this would add them to the grandfather.
Questions on the amendment? Not all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. The AFER amendment is adopted. So now I think we have it in the shape we need it. So Mr. Michael, do we want to do, Representative Rukavina, do you want to do your minerals article now, or should we walk through the whole thing here? What would you like to do?
We can walk through the bill first.
Okay, Mr. Mike.
I have the article in
here. Representative Rukavina and Senator Bach are probably still fighting about it between cell phone calls right now, actually. So.
No, he never fights.
Okay. I was reading to make sure that I agree.
Yeah, okay. Oh, you're here too? I didn't even see you. Okay, so they really are arguing about it. Well, we're good for it as long as you've all agreed. So we'll hold off on that, and then, of course, there may be more amendments. Mr. Michael, Ms. Dalton is going to walk us through the bill.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm going to at least walk you through Article 1, which is aid to local government.
Okay.
These provisions that are in here were all in the conference committee, the VCAS conference committee.
Ms. Dalton, we're going to work off the summary, right? That's where we're at. We've got the 20-some page summary here. So, okay. Thank you. Ms. Dalton.
The major change is that the bill adopts the volatility fix to LGA that was proposed by the League of Minnesota Cities last year, and that was in the veto bill that's adopted here. The taconite aid offset in the LGA formula, that is removed. That had been pretty much agreed on in everybody's LGA formulas that it proposed last year and was in the conference committee report. And then finally, it makes adjustments to payments to Monoman County, City of Monoman, and the Monoman School District related to the fact that there's some dispute over the shooting star casino coming off the tax roll. And so this is basically compensating them for their lost property taxes. And then finally, there is one more section 6 and 7 relate to adjusting tax bases due to the utility property reclassification. Normally, there's a one-year delay before those tax base adjustments show up in the aid formulas, and so this makes it happen a little earlier, so it's kind of consistent to when they actually lose that property tax base. And that was in the bill. Article 2 is property taxes. First section is deals with the town that used to get in lieu payments. This is town of Columbus. It became a city and cities don't get payments in lieu of taxes on natural resource land, that just lets them keep their payments. Who's bill was that? And that's in the tax bill.
Ms. Dalton, whose bill was that? Do you remember?
Detmer.
Okay, thank you. I'm just trying to. Was it made available to all the members whose all bills are in here? There was some running list. Is that in here? Okay. Well, we can continue to provide it. Maybe by 6 o'clock when we come back, because we have a long list of whose bills are in here or not. I'm just trying to remember them as we go. Okay, Ms. Dalton, sorry. Mr. Hines.
Madam Chair, I may ask a little help from Karen on a few of these provisions. So,
We're on page 4 of the summary.
Page 4, section 2 is a section 2 is a minor provision relating to the sales ratio study when properties are sold and the use is going to change. That was from the vetoed bill. Section 3 is a also from the vetoed bill. This is a requirement that the Public Utility Commission adjust rates when due to the property tax changes on utility property that are made in this bill without going through a rate case. This was also from the vetoed bill. Section 4 from the vetoed bill, a minor provision dealing with how modular homes are taxed when they're when they're being sold, when they're on the sort of sales floor, which is actually property in this case. Section 5 is a provision from the vetoed bill, a very minor change that provides an exemption for property used in apprenticeship training programs in certain conditions. A minor change in the size of the city allowable between the vetoed bill and this bill. Section 6, a provision relating to some agricultural structures that were exempted, that have become exempt, and that was from the vetoed bill. Section 7 is also from the vetoed bill. Section 8 is from the vetoed bill, and it has to do with ag homesteads. There's currently a 40-acre minimum circumstance for a special ag homestead, and it was brought to Representative Hamilton's bill, I believe, brought to our attention some cases where these 40 acres, there were parcels that weren't quite 40 acres because of, believe it or not, the curvature of the earth. And this allows them to be counted as 40 acres. Section 9 is also from the vetoed bill, and this is a provision that came from Representative Loeffler's bill originally, which had to do with rental or relative homesteads that were being given to basically in campus areas, and this requires registration of the relative owners in certain circumstances. Again, it's the same as the vetoed bill. Section 10, manufactured homes. This is just a provision that extends an exemption from $500 to $1,000 for storage sheds, decks, etc. Section 11, this is a more substantive provision that reduces the percentage of units for a property to qualify as 4D. Under current law, it has to be that 75% or more of the units are getting the reduced are under government receiving financial assistance. And under this provision, it would only require that 20% of the units be eligible to qualify the building. Although in current law and in this bill, only the units that are under the program would qualify for the lower class rate. This is a Representative Mullery's bill. Section 12 has Class 1B property, increases the tier for the disabled homestead classification, which is currently $32,000, increases it to $50,000.
Mr. Hines, is this Representative Eastland or Representative Rukavina's? Representative Ruth?
That's from later.
Madam Chair, actually, this is from, I believe, the Citizens Property Tax Bill, if
okay.
It has Mark Wirt.
I do think we should get this information. I think we're going to hear a lot of members asking, is that my bill or someone else's, because they can't remember the same language. So I don't know who. I think Representative Simpson has something. He goes from Sarah, maybe, but we'll make that available by 6 o'clock. I think it's a little confusing because I'm just looking at the disabled homestead, and I think Representative Ruth, Rukavina, and Eastland all have provisions in this bill. And I'm just trying to clarify whose is what. So. Sorry, thank you.
Section 13 okay. From the vetoed bill with a slight with a change. This increases the class rates on public utility personal property from the generation equipment, which is the clause 2. Currently at 2%, increases it to 2.5% for pay 09. And 2.8% for pay 210, and for the other classes of utility property that are in clause 3, you can read those from 2% to 2.15% and then to 2.25%. These changes are offset at least at a statewide level. The changes in utility value, the reductions in utility value that are occurring because of the adoption of the new utility rules. This provision is the same as the vetoed bill, except that in the vetoed bill, the pay 210 and thereafter class rate was 3%. So it's been dropped to 2.8% in this bill. Section 14 creates or expands a classification for nonprofit community service organizations such as VFWs and. Under certain conditions, this again is exactly from the veto bill. This was represented.
Wiggum, I think.
Wiggum
and
Gunther.
Wiggum and Gunther and Detmer.
Okay. There's also in both sections 12 and 14, okay. There are some redefinitions of the resort classification that are came from a Department of Revenue recommendation. Section 15 then is what you were referring to earlier, Madam Chair, is the new provision that exempts or excludes, I should say, the much of the value for a homestead of a disabled veteran. They get $150,000 of their market value is excluded for a service-connected disability of at least 70%, and then if it's a total and permanent disability, it's $300,000 market value exclusion. This was the both Representative Eastland and Representative Rukavina had bills in on this topic, and this is kind of a melded version of those two bills. This is exactly as it was in the vetoed bill from last year. Section 16 has to do with who is going to certify the eligibility for Class 1B, the disabled homestead, and it's going to be changing over from the Department of Revenue back to the county to certify who is going to be eligible for that program.
So Mr. Hines, after we finish Representative Lanning's bill, I think we're going to recess because we're going to go to caucus and we're going to come back tonight. So can we just go through Lanning's and stop there? Is that the next one?
Madam Chair, Section 17 isn't really part of the Lanning bill. It's really a follow-up to Section 14. It just states that these new community service organizations that qualify for the Class 4C will be treated as if they're seasonal rec for the purposes of state general tax.
Okay. All right. I think if that's all right, then we'll come back at 6 and... And can everyone put everything back in their folder because we're going to go through it again, and we'll have a list then for everyone to see which member bills are in here and which aren't. It's a little confusing, so we'll see everyone at 6. We are in recess. and continue on the summary. And I know people are working on some technical amendments. We found there's some little things that need to be corrected. And if there are those things, we want to do that here because the goal is not to have a conference committee on this bill. The goal is to have the Senate pass the same bill and off to the governor. So if people have things, please work with staff quietly. And we're just going to go back. Ms. Baker, are you ready to start?
Yes.
I want to first, if I may, could somebody move the minutes for February 18th? And Representative Hooker, will you move the minutes for February 18th? Is there discussion to the minutes? If not, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed say nay. The minutes are adopted. Okay, so let's see. Ms. Baker, can you tell us on the summary where we were? Page of the summary.
Yes, Madam Chair, we are on page 8, section 18.
And Ms. Baker, if it occurs to you,
yes,
because I know you think policy and not only authors, but if it occurs to you as we go, can you tell us the author of the bills we're on? I think it's just helpful.
Okay.
If it occurs,
yes.
And if you just know them off the top of your head, otherwise, it's fine. We're going to quiet down the room just a little bit here. So, Ms. Baker, page 8 of the summary.
Okay, Madam Chair, members, page 8, section 18, this is a provision of Representative Marquardt to allow counties in the non-metro to have these joint public hearings. This provision is exactly the same as was in the vetoed bill, and it deals with the truth in taxation. Section 19 is including airport authorities that are created a special taxing district for purposes of property taxation. That is Representative Bill's bill. Section 20 just deletes it's a requirement that each tax statement contain a line showing the property share of the total amount of state aid. This is also exactly the same as was in the veto bill. Section 21 has to do with the 60-day rule information. It is the same as what was in the veto bill, and it just clarifies some specific information that's required to be given county assessors in cases where a petitioner contests the value of income producing. Section 22 is the same as what was in the vetoed bill to allow an increase in total market value from $200,000 to $500,000 for commercial and industrial property to go into concession and judgment. That's the same provision. Section 23 deals with delinquent taxes. This is also the same as what was in the vetoed bill. This, and I've kind of forgotten on some of these, what provision, this happens to be a Department of Revenue provision, this delinquent taxes, and that just allows partial payments to be made and the order in which they're credited. Section 24, I think that's Representative Bills on the Sustainable Forest, or else it was Senator Box,
I think Senator Joyce. And part of the reason I'm highlighting these is they're working provisions, that the Senate brought to the Conference Committee that overwhelmingly they're mostly the House killed most of the Senate provisions.
Yes.
So they're heavy on House, but there's some Senate.
This provision has been changed since the veto bill in that it was $5 an acre on that minimum floor, and now it's been changed to $7. And it's my understanding the reason why it was changed to $7 is because now for this next year, that's what the minimum payment about is, and it's been it's changed that much over this time period. The next several provisions are identical to what was in the vetoed bill. It has to do with airport authorities, 25, 26, 27, and 28. The only change that was made is in the section 28, which now requires that if the airport authority levies, that they have to have a vote of at least two-thirds of the members of the authority. I'm on page 10, section 28 there, where it references the vote of at least two-thirds. That is the only part of this that is a change provision from the vetoed bill. Section 29 was in the vetoed bill. That just extends the option to defer certain assessments to members of the National Guard and Military Reserve, and this is an option for local governments. And right now, they can do it for seniors and disabled, and this just extends it. This is exactly the same as what was in the veto bill. Section 30, that was Representative Dabney's provision, and that is identical to what was in the vetoed bill that has to do with street maintenance and lighting and for Minneapolis. Sections 31 and 32 deal with the Cook Oar Hospital District that eliminates the limitation on the amount of the levy, and those two provisions are identical to what was in the vetoed bill. And then Section 33 is ANZELS, and that is also identical to what was in the vetoed bill. The repealer, the first repealer just has to do with that City of Minneapolis assessment. That's the same. The Lakeview Cemetery provision is just a repealer because of the change we made in Section 33. And paragraph C is something new in that wheelage tax revenues is a provision which right now says that any wheelage tax has to be offset against property tax, which this came in, the chair and others to put this provision in so that it's not an offset because we don't have levy limits, so it really is irrelevant provision right now because they can just add and then subtract. So anyway, so that provision is new.
Thank you. Where are we going next? Are we going to income taxes? Neither one of you look like income taxes.
Somebody else can come up here.
Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Section 1 of Article 3 is information reporting related to the contractor withholding provision that we discussed briefly this morning. This was in the veto bill last year, and it also is in House Bill 3200. Section 2 is an addition to taxable income for fines and penalties, and that section is for individuals. Section 3 is a subtraction from taxable income for out-of-state military service of members of the National Guard. This was from two separate bills offered by Representatives Broad and Wolfschlager last year. There's a change from what was in the vetoed bill on this provision. In the vetoed bill, this provision was retroactive to tax year 2005, which is when the subtraction for out-of-state service by members of the Guard and Reserve who were called into federal active service was enacted. In this bill, this is effective beginning in tax year 2008, and that change was made in order to make the money in the bill balance out. Section 4 was added in the author's amendment. This is the addition to taxable income for fines and penalties for corporations. Along with the other fines and penalties provisions, this was also in the vetoed bill last year. Section 5 is a military service combat zone credit adjustment that was proposed by the department last year and was included in the vetoed bill. This would allow the combat zone credit to be claimed retroactively by the heirs or estates of service members who were killed after or while performing active duty in a combat zone. The way the law is written now, it could only be claimed by surviving spouses or dependents of the individual who was killed prior to claiming the credit. And that provision would be retroactive to the time period in which the heirs and estates would not have been able to claim it. Section 6 describes the fines, fees, and penalties that would be required to be added to taxable income in Sections 2 and 4 for individuals and corporations. These are items that are allowed to be excluded from federal taxable income. at the federal level. Section 7 is the deferred compensation provision that was discussed this morning. It was included in the veto bill last year and also is included in House File 3200. Section 8 is the withholding for construction contractors. This again was in House File 3200 discussed this morning. This is another revenue raiser. It was in the veto bill last year. Section 9 is an audit and report on the construction contractor withholding. This was proposed last year during the bill process by, I think, the Building Trades Associations and was included in the veto bill. This would let the legislature see how the withholding was going and what types of industries and contractors were affected by it so that you could evaluate it going forward. And that is the end of the income tax article.
Thank you.
And then we come to the federal update article, which with the author's amendment to this bill is exactly the same as the federal update article that was discussed this morning in House File 3200.
I don't think we need to go through it to save time. Unless members have questions, we can go back. But we heard it this morning in the other one, so thank you for that. Ms. Mandy, other questions for Ms. Mandy before we go to sales and use tax? If not, thank you.
Yeah.
And Ms. Dalton, sales and use tax, Article 5, page 19.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, this is a fairly short article. The first section related to manufactured and modular housing is just a kind of a technical cleanup on cytosine of, you know, where are those things subject to local taxes. Section 2 is the prohibition for 2.5 years for local governments to spend money promoting a referendum. And all the remaining sections are the various local sales tax bills that have been included in the omnibus tax bill and the vetoed bill. The exception is the Cook County local sales tax has been modified, only dealing with the local sales tax. It is not dealing with the lodging tax anymore, and it is not allowing a new entertainment tax.
That one got, Senator Bach and I, that one actually got smaller. They're getting less authority than they had in the veto bill. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Okay, thank you. Any questions of anyone on that? Ms. Representative Broad.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Dalton, I'm just wanting to make sure I'm understanding. So the provision related to the sales tax prohibition is just simply for spending money on it. It's not for instituting a sales tax.
Ms. Dalton.
Madam Chair, Representative Broad, first off, that provision doesn't apply to anything that has already been authorized by law.
Mm-hmm.
So it won't apply to any of these. Basically, it prohibits local governments from promoting or spending any money to hold a referendum for a local sales tax. It pretty much says you can't even be out there advocating for one.
Representative Broad, maybe some clarity on that one, because we had a lot of talk in the conference committee about it. We're finding the problem, and, you know, we know people feel differently about these local option sales taxes, but no matter how you feel about them, we were trying to get at the issue that, and this went through the conference committee process and was in the bill, that somehow people have picked up, and it's a, you know, I don't know how they're reading the statute, but they have this belief out there that, you know, if you go take it to your voters, if you promote it and you put it on the ballot and you pass it and then you come here, you can have it. And that's not how it's supposed to work. So there's kind of a feeling out there in some of the communities that, well, we took the vote, so now we have to have it. And that's part of the reason some of the ones that made it through are in there, because they all had elections. And, you know, we wanted to stop the feeling that if people go out and pass them, then we must do it. I mean, it is the state that grants the authority, not the other way around. And so this is to kind of stop some of the activity that's going on, to kind of put a gun to the legislature's head. And obviously, if you like it, you know, like these, then you probably don't like that provision. But that's where that was coming from.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. And if I might just follow up with you on that. I wasn't there for the discussion, so I apologize if it's just rehashing the same old thing. But essentially, then, there's a prohibition on holding these votes for 2 years. My question is, if it's a policy of this body to not allow that to happen, what was the rationale between the two-year breather? The two-year prohibition, did I not hear that
Oh, I think that was a compromise between forever and 2 years.
Okay. Well, I guess
I'm in the forever camp, so you know.
I know you are. You've been very clear. You're always very clear on where you're at, and I appreciate that. I'm just trying to understand. I'm concerned a little bit about the forward-backward type approach with some of these in terms of fairness. We have some that are, you know, we're going to say for 2 years nobody can do this except for the people who have already done it and except for those people who are going to do it for the purposes of transportation. And for 2 years nobody else can do it. And then maybe you can come back and try it again 2 years from now. And so I'm just a little concerned about uneven and unlevel situation throughout the state.
And that's a good point. I mean, I think that would be a provision if you feel that way, that, you know, you would oppose that particular provision, hopefully not the whole bill. I guess I'd just respond in saying that, you know, Senator Bach and I actually tried to pass through the conference committee on no more local sales taxes forever. And this was sort of a compromise with cities who are saying, well, you know, how about if you could just back off for a few years and kind of think about them. The ones that made it through, you know, are a fraction of what was requested, and what they had in common was they already took the vote, and they were not necessarily the best projects, in my opinion. And then the one exception was Crookston, the flooding. Just like we didn't make the other community that had flooding take a vote. It was a crisis. And I don't, Representative Marco, which community was that? In past years, or Ms. Dalton, there was somebody else that had a previous crisis. And, but I understand, you know, that we, Representative Dorman used to always say, and he was right, even though he loved them and I hated them, what we agreed on was, it appears to the public as though this is a political game, that if you're this legislator in this community and, you know, whatever, you get your thing. And we tried to say if the election was taken, you're in.
What's wrong with that?
But even though I didn't want to do any of them, it was, you know, some of them had passed with, I think, Representative Moe's passed with, I think, 72% of the electorate. Or no, maybe his was a tight one. It was somebody else's was overwhelming. We had this kind of list of who went through and which people were waiting to vote and which people have tried and failed. Even people who tried and failed were coming and asking for them. And that was just, okay, you took the vote, you're in, and then let's just stop for a while. And one way to do that would be to stop hiring lobbyists and stop hiring people to actually promote these things with your electorate, hold an election, and then come to the legislature and say, yeah, but we already passed it, and, you know, we already had an election, and then take the pressure away from legislators to think about the, is it a good policy at all? So, anything else on the local option sales tax? Okay, Article 6.
Article 6 deals with gin accelerated tax payments for sales tax, cigarette and tobacco tax, and liquor tax. Basically, right now, people with a liability of $120,000 or more annually have to pay 78% of their June liability in June, and that amount will move to 80%, which will raise, I believe, about $6.3 million, which is needed to kind of make this bill balance out.
Ms. Dalton, can I just ask, okay, so everyone understands, the veto bill, the revenue sources in this bill are the exact same as what was in the veto bill, minus the FOC. I mean, they're the ones that were not objected to, and the June accelerator was actually higher. And was it at, instead of from going from 78 to 80, I think it went to 85 or 87, or can you remind us?
Members of the committee, it was 85, it went up to 85% in the veto tax bill.
Okay, thank you. Other questions on Article 6? Representative Simpson.
Well, I think you just answered my question. I didn't realize it was at 80, I didn't realize it was 85, and I couldn't agree to that.
I don't think you voted for that.
I think I probably said no, yeah. We should make sure we thank all our retailers for doing that. You know, if interest-free loan to the state of Minnesota, it will make them pay every summer here when they do this. So.
And Representative Simpson, I mean, you know, I'll just say it right here for those who care about this provision. I agree with Representative Simpson completely. And when Representative Coles mentioned earlier, you know, isn't the first one kind of a shift? And I said, no, the next bill, that's the one that's got the shift in it, that's it. It isn't it. And the reason Senator Bach and I use this approach is kind of the deal for this bill is you had to make it through the conference committee and land on the governor's desk. And that's how you end up in this bill. I actually prefer the other method that we did this morning. But that was never proposed last year. It was never a bill. It's in closer conference committee. It's in the governor's desk. This provision actually did and was not cited in the veto letter. And it was a significantly higher amount of revenue raises. This is actually shrinking it much further down. And the governor did not object. And I wish we had brought the veto letter so people could look at it. But that was not cited. And I know the governor has expressed an interest to me personally and that he is interested in getting some of these bills passed and cleared through as long as we weren't in the veto bucket. And so that one is not cited in that letter. So, you know, I don't know. I guess Representative Broad has it, and we can maybe get the pages to copy and pass out, because I think it's going to come up later in another provision.
Madam Chair, I do have that, and it will come up as we try to figure out what is deemed to be non-controversial. I also, for the purposes of the committee, actually went online and pulled a definition of what's non-controversial, and so I'll hand this to the pages so we can have that discussion, too. But I certainly will get copies of the veto letter, because I'll be discussing a little bit later the utility tax provisions, because those actually were mentioned in that letter and I think are extremely controversial to this day.
Yes, sure. And, you know, before we go further on that, because we are going to get into that, but we want to get to the summary, I do want to just mention the bill has been called the non-controversial tax bill. That was probably an error. I don't know how we put it on the agenda, but I'm pretty sure we made sure not to call it non-controversial. Do we have the agenda today? I just want to see, because it says income, corporate property, and special tax items from the vetoed 2007 tax bill. And it's being called that casually around here. But what I should say is, I mean, it's certainly controversial to you if your bill got in, or someone's bill got in and yours didn't. Or if there was one provision in the bill you didn't like, that's a controversial provision. Non-controversial is how it was getting tossed around. What it meant to us as we started discussing it is you made it through the process and you weren't a point of controversy in the veto letter. So the one you're going to bring up later is legitimately there. But every other provision was not cited in the governor's veto letter. And there were hundreds of provisions, and he really wrote about six of them. And had stated publicly that he didn't have any problems with the rest of the bill. So that's what we're trying to work on, is the rest of the bill. So, you know, the non-controversial word choice is not the greatest. I agree with you, Representative Broad. Okay, so are we on Article 7? Yes, Representative Rukavina.
You want me to do this for extension on Article 4?
I think we're going to get through the whole summary and then just start with your amendment. Is that okay? Okay, because we're almost through. Except for Representative Rukavina has a whole article to stick in. Not just the bill, a whole article. Mr. Michael.
Madam Chair, the next article is the special taxes article. Section 1 is the estate tax auditing authority. This was the Department of Revenue provision, and the language is slightly modified as a result of an agreement between the Department of Revenue and the Bar Association. Article 2 is the dedication of the ATV gas tax, the increase in that percentage. Section 3 is Representative Atkins' bill on the forfeited cigarettes. Section 4, I believe, is Representative Lincheski's bill that was Representative Hausman's bill for Minnesota Life to provide an exemption from the retaliatory tax. Section 5 is the extension of the Hennepin County deed and mortgage tax. I believe that was Representative Mullery's bill. Section 6 is the Ramsey County. Let's see, that's Section 6,
that was Murphy.
7, and 8. That's Representative Murphy's extension of the county deed and mortgage tax. Sections 9 and 10 are the St. Louis County deed and mortgage tax. Section 11 and 12 are the Dakota County deed and mortgage tax. Section 13 and 14 is the Anoka County, and I believe that was Representative Bortman's. I forget who the other ones were. Section 15 is a provision from the Senate tax bill that extended the Northwest Airlines exemption from the petrol fund tax. Article 8 contains the economic development provisions. It has Section 1 is the border city allocation. This has been cut in half because the the payments that would have been made in fiscal 08 have passed already, so it's $750,000 rather than $1.5 million. The next provisions are all the TIF technical provisions, which I will just skip over, since I'm sure no one wants to go through those. Sections 15, 16, and 17 are Representative Hillstrom's bill for Brooklyn Center. Section 18 and 19 are Representative Mullery's bill for the Minneapolis Housing Replacement District. Section 20 was a Senate provision that reauthorizes the permitted use of an old appropriation for the International Economic Development Zone, that's the air freight zone. Section 21 is the Burnsville TIF provision. Section 22, and that was Representative Morgan's provision. Section 22 is Representative Welty's, and I believe other...
Demmer. Welty and Demmer.
For EOTA, they had four cities. The conference committee gave them only one. Section 23 was Fidley TIF. Section 24 is the New Brighton TIF. And the repealer is part of the Burnsville and the TIF technical. Article 9 is the public finance article, and this basically is the public finance provision as passed as part of the vetoed bill with a couple of date updates. Authority to issue debt for software expired on July 1st, so the language now, the effective date on that has changed to make it a reinstatement and make it effective immediately. Representative Schumper's changes to the county CIP bonds are in this as well. Representative Hornstein's bill that authorized the Met Council transit bonds are in here. The chair's bill that authorized the trust for post-employment health benefits and the issuing bonds for that purpose are also in here. Representative Dill's Crane Lake certificates of indebtedness, section 28, is in this article, as well as Representative Szymanski's Winstead bonding authority in section 29. The remainder of the bill through up to the final article are all Department of Revenue provisions. All of these have been updated for dates. The Department of Revenue has also made some minor changes in them. I don't think you will want to go through these in any detail. The one thing to point out is that in the sales tax department provisions, the update for the Streamlined Sales Tax Act is contained in that article, and that does have a cost which shows up on the spreadsheet. Moving ahead to the very last article so that you can be done with this and get on to amendments. Miscellaneous article. Sections 1, 2, and 3, 4...
And Mr. Michael, this is page 56 from Emmer's in the summary.
Correct. The first five sections of those were requests from the Department of Finance related to local impact notes and their preparation, which is the Department of Finance responsibility. That, again, was, you know, passed as part of the vetoed bill. There are two revenue recapture provisions... I cannot remember who the members were that carried those. They may one or more of them may have come from the Senate. Representative Norness's gravel tax for the town of Gambler is in Section 8, and Section 9 again is the Department of Finance. I believe it was the Department of Finance that repealed the rebate requirement statute. That's pretty much it. If anyone has any questions, I'll try to respond to them.
Okay. So that's the whole summary. Does anyone have any questions for Mr. Michael on any of the provisions in the whole the whole summary, all 57 pages? Because if not, we'll just go to amendments. Representative Broad.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Zellers had a couple of questions related to that deductibility portion. Did he ask those? Did I miss that?
Deductibility portion, I'm sorry.
Regarding fees and penalties, the provision that was, it's a new provision, I believe, that came through the conference committee report that did not get heard by this committee, and I'm just trying to find it in here. Mr. Michaels can kind of walk through the history of that provision and whether it kind of popped up in conference committee or where it came from.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the substantive language for this is found on in Article 3, Section 5, which is on page 54 of the bill. And this is a provision that's been I don't know that I would characterize it as a perennial provision of the Senate tax bill, but it's been in the Senate on the tax bill at least a couple of times before this last year, and it was a provision that was in the Senate tax bill, and it was adopted by the conference committee. And in effect, what it does is, under federal law, there are certain kinds of penalties that rise to a fairly high level of criminality. They're not necessarily criminal, but they're penalties that indicate a fairly strong violation of public policy that are not deductible. This provision goes beyond that and includes somewhat lower levels of fines and penalties as non-deductible items, so they would be added back both at the individual and the corporate level. It raises a small amount of revenue, and again, it was one of the provisions that the conference committee agreed to. I think there are some definitional issues with regard to exactly what's covered. I'm not in any way an expert on this.
Okay, thank you. Representative Rukamina, can we do your amendment first?
Sure, ma'am. Sure, I got the amendments here to pass both.
And yours, Representative Bill. Since I guess you've agreed. So.
Yeah. And Representative Silberg, who's here.
Oh, he's in the fiscal, or in the
finance committee presenting his efficiency bill, I believe. Madam Chair, let me just quickly tell you what's in the bill. First of all, there's 4 cents to schools that have a mine or a plant in them, and 2 cents to the rest of the school districts in the taconite relief areas. The tax has escalated. This year it will be about a little over 17 cents in the last 3 years a ton. There are ore docks and power plants that used to not be taxed because they were owned by a company that just had hauled freight and used the docks for themselves, and all go on the tax rolls. There is 2 cents going to the Iron Range Higher Education District. Another section allows the IRRB board to vote with a majority vote to use taconite money to purchase land out of the Doug Johnson Trust Fund, because we've got a lot of forest land all of a sudden from Boise and Potlatch and those type of companies that is being fragmented and broken up. Tower, there's another section allows Tower and Sedan to qualify for municipal aid from the taconite formula. The aggregate tax is applied to tailings as is applied in current law to other aggregates. There's a provision that pays $500,000 a year to Mesabi School District for a school bond. And finally, there is a remainder of a portion of funding at the IRRB agency that sunsetted a few years ago, where there's some leftover dollars that is going to Virginia and Gilbert to connect their sewer and water lines. And that is basically this amendment. And it's agreed on by all of us, and everything in here except, I believe, the power provision was in last year's bill.
Members, so Representative Rukavina moved the A081124 amendment. Discussion to the amendment. And I just want to remind members, both vetoed tax bills had mineral provisions. What left the conference committee had a minerals provision. And I want to just take a minute to thank Ms. Baker, who worked through the weekend with this group of thugs, and called me Friday and Saturday and Sunday.
Because there was a breakdown in communication.
There was a breakdown, and so they agreed.
And Madam
Chair, pull it out. And now it's back.
There was only one definition of non-controversial in the Webster's. I sent the second provision, which is, when an Iron Range delegation meeting is called and Representative Bill threatens not to sit on me. So that's non-controversial.
And thank you, really, because you worked very hard.
And I would appreciate that.
One technical amendment.
Yes.
And so
it's on page 13, line 9.
I forgot that. It's already.
The language, the remainder of the should be deleted. And then on line 10, it should be deleted up to the word all, so that it just starts with all distributions received in 2009 and subsequent years. That got duplicated, and I didn't get it out. So
okay.
Those two words should be taken out.
The author incorporates that into the amendment, and I should say, members, because this was not ready to go before the bill was printed, there's no summary on this, but there is no fiscal cost on this article. In the bill. It's a zero item on the spreadsheet.
I would like to thank Ms. Baker also because she put up with me for 2 days. And
that is the project.
Discussion to the A081124 amendment.
Madam Chair.
Representative Simpson.
Just a question for Representative Rukavina. You mentioned something about the docks that weren't taxed, and now you're going to tax these docks. What's the basis?
There was a, when LCV and then North Shore Steel had their own rail lines and ore docks, they weren't common carriers. The other railroads and docks were taxed, and Senator Bach and Representative Bill felt that these docks should be taxed too. So they're being taxed, they're being put in fiscal disparity district, which is already on the range, so 60% of the money will stay locally and 40% will be put in the Iron Range fiscal disparity pool.
Okay. Further discussion on the amendment that's before us. Representative Pulver, you're on board on this?
Yeah.
Yes, this is the mineral article. We've been told you support it. Okay.
He told you that.
All those in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed say nay. The amendment is adopted. And if we can go, we have three sort of technical ones that we're going to take, and then we have Representative Vito Forrest and Simpson that I'm aware of. The first is Representative Jaros, and that's the A8 amendment. It should be coming out right now, the A8 amendment. And Representative Jaros, do you want to explain to us what's in there?
Yes, Madam Chair, lady. The $37,931,000 is last year's or 2 years' the construction cost for the local portion. And construction costs increased, it seems to me, almost as high as healthcare costs. So it has gone up about $2,300,000 or so to $40,285,000. That's the local portion of the debt expansion. This provision was approved by the voters 62-38 in Duluth 2-3 years ago. At the request of the governor.
Thank you, Representative Jaros. So Representative Jaros moves the 83201A8 amendment, and I should again tell members without having to drag Ms. Templin up here that this is a zero provision. This is, Duluth is, the numbers don't work anymore on this local option sale, so they're going to be able to raise a little bit more to account for the lag and the passage of the time of the election. So it's not an increase for our spreadsheet. It's for Duluth to have more authority to go from about $38 million to $40. Discussion to the amendment.
Aye.
All those in favor? Aye. Opposed say nay. The A8 amendment is adopted. Thank you. And now we have Representative Marquardt. I don't have a number for you, Representative Marquardt.
Madam Chair, A5 amendment.
Representative Marquardt moves the A5 amendment. And I guess they're coming out now. Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. This amendment was brought to me by the Minnesota Association of Townships. And what it does, it clarifies the establishment of subordinate service districts in townships. And the way the process is supposed to work is that in a service district, this could be like a sewer or water district if they want that service. And the way it would work is that, and it's in the law, but it says a petition signed by at least 50% of the property owners has to petition the town board, and then the town board has to establish this service district. It's unclear, according to townships, it looks like to them that a town board could just establish this without the petition, and they just want to clarify what's already there to say it has to be a petition by the people, and then the town board can establish. So it leaves the people in the process, and it's just a clarification.
Okay, so discussion to the A5 amendment. And I should have asked, I apologize, I should have asked if there was anyone from the public who wanted to testify in Representative Rukavina's minerals article. I'm certain there's not, but I'll ask it now because we'll take it. And if there was anyone who wanted to testify on the technical change for Duluth, and I can't imagine, but I apologize, I forgot. So now I'm going to ask, is there anyone who would like to testify on behalf of the townships? I don't know if they're in here. They brought it to us saying it's really a technical problem. They just wanted to clean up. So if there is no public testimony on that and no discussion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say nay. The A5 amendment is adopted. And then Representative Marquardt has another, and I believe this is another problem now with the outdated local option sales tax. Representative Marquardt moves the H3201A7 amendment. Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. And what the A7 amendment does is it deals with the city of Bemidji local option sales tax, and it clarifies that the $40 million listed there would be for construction only. And that's the one part. And then the other part clarifies when the 30 years begins, and would that be after the end of the expiration of the other local option sales tax. So
is there testimony from the public on this? This is, again, the election has happened a while ago. The numbers now don't work for getting the project done. Discussion? No? All those in favor of the A7 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say nay. The amendment is adopted. Representative De La Forest, I don't know. I guess we've got it up here.
You know what? Madam Chair, I think I can save staff a little bit of work. I would withdraw the A6 amendment, and I would instead just offer a simple oral amendment, and here's why. This deals with the deed tax, the mortgage and deed tax provisions, and of course it applies, I believe, to St. Louis. You've got Hennepin and Ramsey extending a sunset, and then there's Dakota and Anoka that would be added. And my amendment reached all of those counties, and I didn't think that was right. I haven't talked to any of the representatives on this committee who represent that county. Perhaps you support it, perhaps you don't. I just think, didn't think it was right for me to offer an amendment that perhaps with which you disagreed affecting your county. So I'd like to at least offer an oral amendment on page 83 to remove sections 13 and 14. What that is the establishment of a new mortgage and deed tax for Anoka County. And at least in my view, Madam Chair, speaking for my constituents, it's a tax increase that we don't need right now, especially in this environment with the real estate sector being hit. So it is my hope I can prevail upon my colleagues tonight to at least excuse Anoka County from this provision. I'd be happy to stand for any questions.
Okay, from Representative De La Forest, page 83,
Madam Chair, sections 13 and 14.
Okay, so
and I apologize for not having that drafted, but as I said, you understand why.
You know, and I do, and I appreciate, and I hope the other authors in the other counties appreciate that Representative De La Forest is just trying to weigh in on his county, and I want to urge members to oppose the amendment. I think Representative De La Forest knows that I was going to say that, but I do want to say that Representative De La Forest has been very consistent and has, as you recall, had opposed this provision from the beginning and did not want Anoka County to have this this tax work in this way. Representative Portman is the author, and so I am, you know, encouraging people to support keeping it in. But I do Representative Gila Forrest is, I think, using this time to show his personal opposition to this, and I would encourage members to not support the amendment. But Representative Dielfort has been very fair in how he's been trying to address this. So, further discussion? And we don't have a number, so we're going to take the vote on the oral amendment. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed say nay.
No.
The amendment is not adopted, and we've got that on the record for you, Representative Dielfort. And, you know, later we're going to have some big party with you at the end of the session. You've all heard, you know, where Representative Dielfort doesn't like us anymore, I guess. So we're going to have a good long session with him first and put him through the paces.
I'll be here to the end.
Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair, our deeds to our houses and have them burn them.
There's probably a tax on that, Madam Chair.
Okay, so now we've got...
Thank you. She hooked up.
The only other amendment I am aware of is Representative Simpson. So if there are more, please bring them on up. But Representative Simpson is now going to move the H3201A4 amendment. Representative Simpson.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. In this non-controversial bill that I so eagerly grabbed onto, it soon found that there were some people that read through it and found something that kind of stuck out that was very controversial. And my phone began ringing early and continued. As Representative Broad has passed out this letter indicating the veto letter from the governor last year, it has to do with the fact that the class ratings for utilities were going to be increased, and they were being done on page 12, section 3, and page 25, section 13. I don't want to see this committee go through all this work and all the effort that was put into it last year to see this bill go down in a blaze of fire again. So I would like to see this deleted at this time.
Okay, so members...
Madam Chair?
Yes. Representative Solberg.
Madam Chair, usually when I ask a question, I have some idea what the answer is going to be, but I don't on this one. Sometimes I'm surprised by the answer also, even though I thought I knew what the answer was. But in this particular case, if we remove this provision, what does that do to the state budget as far as the additional cost that we would pay from the state budget for school districts?
Mr. Michael, do you have who would like to try to answer that question?
Commissioner.
Think about that for a minute here.
Well, Madam Chair, the reason I ask that question is that there's a few districts that are affected by this amendment, and mine is one of them. My auditor, who is a very strong Republican, and bless him dearly for that, has talked to me several times about this change that needs to be done. And it not only affects the property tax in the county itself, the homeowners in our particular county, but it, I think from a state perspective, it has some fiscal implications on the amount of money that would be affected in the state pays off the school. As if we give one taxpayer, in this particular case in my county and one of my school districts, a very large property tax wealth, we reduce the rate, it has to have an effect, and put that shifted to other taxpayers, which would be the county and the township, which is, we understand that's a shift. But the shift to the city is one, or to the state is what I want to ask, because when you reduce the local components from the local property tax to the school, the city, the state has to make up that particular debt. It may be a small amount, but it is a significant shift in some districts from a property tax wealth to a state. So I'd like to at least have some fiscal implication of what that this amendment means.
Well, Madam Chair. Well, first of all, we're not reducing a tax, we're increasing. So from that standpoint, in this bill, we're increasing that rate. I think there are people sitting at the desk that can give you a lot better answer, Representative Solberg, than I can on your question, and I think it's a good, solid question. So with that, go ahead.
Madam Chair, I think you're probably increasing a rate prospectively.
Mm-hmm.
But if you don't have the law that's being proposed, if you have your amendment, it has a shift to the state prospectively.
Okay, so let's get an answer from Mr. Hines and Ms. Still, and I think then Representative Wolfhager is on this point, and Representative Broad. Ms. Still.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, first of all, there are a couple of different things going on here. The spreadsheet on page 3, line 67, indicates an impact of the property tax class rate provision as a PTR impact in the years 2010 and 2011. What's happening is that the shifts are occurring and people will have a change in income that will cause us to pay out more in property tax. The specific question that Representative Solberg is asking has to do with the impact specifically on school districts, and I don't have that printout available at this time.
Mr. Hines.
Madam Chair, Representative Solberg, I don't have a printout either, but I do know that we no longer have, to the nearly the degree we used to have, such a high component of equalization in the school levies, such that a dollar of lost tax base translates into a dollar of increased state aid. A lot of our equalization now is on the referendum levies, which is on referendum net tax, referendum market value, and that's not affected by this change because that's market value, not class rates. So it would only be in the equalization aid programs, and there are not so many of those, and many of the most affected districts don't qualify for any equalization aid anyway. So my thinking is that it would be a fairly minimal impact, but I don't have a printout I can show you, and if we have any, they're old. They're not, they haven't been updated. And I don't know if Ms. Schill's reading from the Department of Revenue, if they address other impacts at all.
You know, I have the revenue estimate from Department of Revenue here. Bullet points identify that this estimate was done on the payable 08 property tax model. Current law includes phase-in implementation of changes to the public utility valuation rules. The increase is to offset the net tax shifting due to the rule change. Taxes would be shifted from public utility property from other types, but it's not giving me any more specific information on the exact impact for those other types. Property taxes on homesteads would decrease by $9.6 million payable in 2009 and by $16.5 million payable in 2010. Lower homestead taxes will result in lower property tax refunds estimated to be the $620,000 and the $1.1 million that I mentioned in the spreadsheet. I don't have any further detail on that.
Thank you, Representative Fulber.
Thank you for the question.
Okay.
Maybe I could ask.
Oh, Madam Chair.
Representative Rubin, at this point?
Yeah.
So well, good work on getting.
I guess to the point of the amendment itself, and that is that, if I recall correctly, this issue, and I don't remember it that well, but it was that the Department of Revenue made it basically a legislative decision, I would feel, and some classification rates for it or something, and lowered the property tax for utilities, and basically spreads the burden to other people. I happen to have one of those school districts that isn't property wealthy, and this affected it. So, Representative Simpson, it's a question of, do you want the homeowners to pay the utilities? And I'd rather have the utilities pay. And that's what's currently the way it works until this decision was made by the Department of Revenue. And I think it's our responsibility in the Constitution to determine this and not folks that are nice, but they're bureaucrats. Okay. They don't have to answer that.
Well, to that point, Representative Rickavina, it isn't the utility company that pays. It's the consumer. Well, and it's the final purchaser of the product. So as we're continuing this environment and continually making changes and putting more burdens on our cost of utilities, this is just another cost on utilities that will be passed on to me, you, the end consumer, the end user. So, again, it's left hand, right hand, but I think that that this is just overstepping.
Madam Chair, to that point,
Representative Rukavina, were you?
Well, I know my ally over here.
Well, we're all on that point, and Representative Wolfiger was actually first to the point.
Well, I just want to correct the statement that the Department of Revenue made a decision. I mean, the Department of Revenue was a player in it, but also there was an administrative law judge that played into this as well in terms of making the change and in terms of the fact that the utilities were actually overpaying. And so that's being left out of the discussion, so I just want to put that on the table as well. And I'll just wait in line for my
Madam Chair. Representative Rosavina.
I guess what does it say in the Constitution that they should determine tax policy in this state?
Representative Rosavina, then you and I agree about activist judges.
Well, yes, we do. I still am trying to get the ones that made the president 8 years ago. You're on my side again.
And you know, I think going forward, we're going to go to Representative Wolfiger now. We're going to end up hearing from folks who are here to support Representative Wolfiger and their community, and we're going to hear, I'm sure, from the commissioner and others. I do think for those who may be following this or for those who are sleeping, because not everybody in this room cares about this provision, but some of us do a lot. And I think Representative Rukavina and Representative Broad are both right here in that, you know, the lawsuit challenged was the Department of Revenue doing the right thing. And the result of that lawsuit is it said the utilities were right. They were being overvalued. Often people take that argument to say then therefore the legislature has to follow suit. And I think so Representative Broad is right in saying that was how it played out. And but Representative Rukavina is also right because it is the legislature who can decide if they would like to have some ability for the host communities to receive revenue as it relates to being host to adverse impacts in their community. So Representative Simpson and Representative Rukavina, I think, have it right there, too, in that...
Who's wrong?
Representative Rukavina, I mean, the crux of the amendment, in my mind, is really you are letting the property taxpayers locally then pick up the cost of losing those that revenue they had, and Representative Rukavina is saying, you know, hey, we're the user of utilities, and if you get to pass it through to all of Minnesota anyhow as consumers, and who should pay? Ratepayers or the local abutting communities? And so, you know, there is significant tax policy here for the future that affects a lot of people in this room, and it has been very controversial. So, you know, we're all, I guess, have points, but now we're going to hear from Representative Wolfiger on all of this.
Well, all right, Chair members. Really, what we're talking about is an equity in tax policy, and it's because we've had this new utility valuation rule adopted by the Department of Revenue. That's what we've been talking about. But this new utility valuation rule devalues the electric utility property throughout the state by approximately 27%. And the rule change negatively impacts local government. Now, the GOR has estimated that there are 33 cities, 177 townships, 6 counties, and 32 school districts that will suffer a greater than 1% loss in the revenue as a result of this rule change. Now, the reason I'm talking about it is because the city of Redding is in my district, and it's a host to a large nuclear power facility. And again, according to the DOR, the new assessment rule will create a $1.36 million shortfall for Red Wing. And to Lauren's point and to Rukavina's point, that's a 6% increase in the home property tax increases. The Red Wing School District, the Goodview County, will experience shortfalls too. And statewide, there's a tax shift of $34 million on the residential, homestead, and commercial industrial property. I'm talking about this because it's a hardship for my district. But I also want to make this point that this does not make up the difference. And I object, Representative Simpson, when you talk about this being in the bill, there's been a change. Because what was in the governor's veto bill talked about a windfall. The windfall was actually not for my city, it was for Becker. And if anything, you know, the controversy, you talk about the controversy, well, first of all, this says income, corporate property, and special tax items from the veto 2000 tax bill. Now, I've been here a grand total of a year. You know, I came here a year ago, and the Republicans couldn't even say the word tax. Remember that? A year ago, you guys spit out the word fee. Fee. You couldn't say tax. Well, I heard tax tonight. So you've made a little bit of a ground. You know, when I came here a year ago, people didn't want to carry legislation for Republicans. You know the kind of grief I got a year ago? What the heck are you doing? Why are you going to carry a bill that includes Becker? Becker's not a Democratic district. What the heck are you carrying a bill for Monticello? Monticello's not a Democratic district. But you know what? I grew up in this area where there wasn't a sewer plant. And I said it wasn't right for the people of Red Wing. It's not right for Monticello. It's not right for Becker. It's not right for all these other communities. Do you know that Xcel Energy's taxes are the same today as they were in 1990? There isn't another industry, another home owner, another property, commercial industry person that can say that. That's what we've been putting up with. Do you think I'm mad about it? I'm mad. I'm sick and tired of it. Now, this classification rate has to equal 3.09%. Not 2.5 in 2009, not 2.8 in 2010. But I've been asked by the city of Red Wing to go ahead and support this because it does do some good for the city, the school district, and the county. Frankly, the bill actually does help cities and Republican districts more than it does my own. Think about that. In other words, Red Wing loses $350,000 per year in revenue at this rate, at this 2.8%. So my point is it has been compromised. And I wouldn't have a whole bunch of people from my city, and frankly, there's people in the audience from Republican districts here waiting and hoping that someone speaks up to them. I'm doing that. But I'm tired of it. I'm tired of this. You know, you guys make up words, controversy. You're using the word controversy for income, corporate property, and special tax items. I'm done for now.
Thank you for that, Representative Wolfmeyer. And I think it's obvious to everyone that this is a very issue that evokes a lot of passion for those host communities. And that's exactly what people are trying to address here. These people are hosting these facilities that all of us are enjoying what's produced at these facilities. So thank you for that. I have Representative Broad on the list next. We're also going to take public testimony. So, Representative Broad.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll actually be quick so we can get to the public testimony because I'm sure it's folks who are on the ground and dealing with it as well. But just a couple points is that when we talk about passing it through to the ratepayers, I don't believe that pipelines can actually do that. The rates are set. So when we talk about, you know, doing that with the utilities, there's a different structure in place for the different types of utilities. The other thing is in Representative Simpson's amendment, it does not take away the transition aid to the cities and the transition aid to the schools. And so it's important in when we talk about the money that's out there and how we're offsetting this change in rule, it's important to know that that transition aid is actually still intact, even if his amendment passes, which I do hope it does. And then we're talking about tax fairness. I mean, as a tax policy rationale, does it make sense for us to say to a group of people who have essentially been determined to have been overpaying, to have been overcharged, that the way that we're going to solve the problem of you being overcharged and of you overpaying is that we're going to actually charge you more to equal it out? I mean, there's just a lacking logic in coming back to folks who have been overcharged and saying we're just going to charge you more to make it work and make it even. I mean, there's improvements that go on in these plants. There's additional property tax. They pay both CI and property tax. It's a situation of double taxation in the first place. And so, I hope that we'll talk about this in a reasonable, rational tax policy discussion because I do think it's an important issue.
all of the things that are going on to the utilities end up with the ratepayers. In a pipeline situation, it's a little bit different, but there's all sorts of tax policy rationale and reason for why we shouldn't be just throwing this in. And whether the bill is non-controversial or not, Representative Walshager, we didn't coin that term. It was put on the table. And our hope
here.
Absolutely.
No, it's not on this agenda.
Representative Walshager and Representative Lincesti, it has been portrayed in many ways that the bills that are coming forward were going to be non-controversial bills. And whether people mistook that or not, the fact of the matter is that we need to move things forward in a way that is reasonable. And if we want to get bills signed into law, we need to put provisions on the table that are not going to get vetoed. This provision, and Representative Lincesti mentioned a couple times that we're bringing forward provisions that were not included in the veto letter. This one was. And so we do need to take that into account as we're portraying what we're trying to do with this bill. This bill contains a provision that was contained in the veto letter, and it does not bode well.
Justin Broad, I want to use your own definition here so we can all, you know, move on past that one. I think I tried to highlight that maybe that wasn't the best choice of words, but what we meant by non-controversial meant the first one, your first synonym, which was agreed upon. So again, the menu of 75 or 100 bills in here were agreed upon in the conference committee and not cited in the veto letter. Your point, were they cited in the veto letter? Yes. And we want to get to the testimony, and Commissioner Innes, Representative Solberg, and Representative Wolfsager are waiting to your point. But I want to make clear on that, and that will come out when we have Commissioner Innes up here. I mean, we did think we were... Senator Bach and I thought we had agreed on that, and I think Commissioner Innes was going to tell you that he doesn't think we did. So that's how it got in here. Okay, we thought we had a change here, two of the three of us. So, you know, we're going to keep talking about that, but I do want to give Representative Solberg.
I will pass.
Okay, and Representative Wolfwater.
Well, to this point, Representative Broad, you know, the reason that utilities like Xcel can pass along the rate hike is because they negotiated that. And it does give me heartburn. You know what also gives me heartburn is that Xcel Energy posted profits of 37% last quarter. And the nuclear plant Red Wing, it's a cash cow. On any given day, it can generate profit of $350,000 to $1 million a day. So, you know, I also question some things. I question these profits. I question how long the state and the nation should continue offering this kind of benefit to a regulated industry. I'm sure you're well aware a regulated industry enjoys the power of eminent domain, has lawsuit protection, and it has a public utility commission that can automatically pass this stuff along just because they ask for it. So, yeah, I have heartburn with this stuff too. But it's negotiated by the utility companies to do that, not by the people.
To this point, if not, we're going to go to Red Wing now, who is here, Carol Duff. If you'd like to join us, or anyone else who's with you from Red Wing, please, welcome. And maybe Representative Wolfsack, if you want to tell us who Ms. Duff is.
Yes. This is Ms. Carol Duff. She is the president of the City Council of Red Wing, and she came here at 10 o'clock this morning and has been waiting all day because she feels she's a spokesperson for the people of Red Wing.
Thank you. Ms. Duff, welcome.
Good evening, Madam Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Carol Duff, City Council President of Red Wing. And once again, we in Red Wing feel it's important that you hear our comments in support of House File 3201. What would be the reaction of any of your communities to building a nuclear power plant? With the energy shortages, proposals will be coming forward for power plants for the future. Few communities would have chosen to take on a nuclear plant. However, Red Wing took that risk. Red Wing educated its citizens on safe nuclear practice and said yes in 1973 because of the tax benefit that we were promised it would bring to us. One other city, Monticello, did that, and all of Minnesota has benefited by the clean energy of these plants. Since September 11th, my Red Wing community has had to deal with heightened security because of the nuclear plant, increasing our cost for homeland security. For 6 weeks after September 11th, the city of Red Wing was unable to use its municipal airport, and numerous planes fly into that for commercial purposes every day. The Department of Revenue rule change is the reason that we are here. The tax benefit that induced us to accept a nuclear plant is being jerked away from us. Excel can ask the court and the Department of Revenue to cut back their tax. Statewide, there's been a reduction of $34 million, which has been shifted onto residential homesteads and commercial education. I call to your attention your own distribution of property taxes in Minnesota. I call to your attention that residential homesteaded taxes have increased by 78% since 2002. Residential non-homesteaded taxes have increased 176%. Commercial industrial have increased 22.6%. The only property taxes that have gone down is public utilities, which your own document shows now at a negative 1.7. Compare that to 78 or 176 or even 22. Red Wing cannot ask Excel to shut down one of its reactors. They can take away our tax, but can we take anything away from Excel Energy? Can we ask them to shut down one of their reactors? Say if they want to not pay the tax, maybe we should not support a nuclear power plant. We ask you esteemed legislators to be fair. When the ship goes from the power plant paying its fair share to property tax, trying to make up that difference for the school, for the county, for the city, we are placed in a very negative position. We only ask for fairness. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. And we do have a handout for you.
The piece as well as just you. Thank you, Ms. Duff. And if you could just stay, we may have questions for you. Ms. Duff, any questions for Ms. Duff? No? Okay. If not, thank you for your testimony. And we'll have the pages pass out your handout. Were there other folks from Red Wing or any of the host communities who wanted to testify? Okay. Are there members of the utility community who want to testify?
You got one.
Mr. Carlson, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. I'm Keith Carlson. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Intercounty Association that includes three host counties within its membership. I'm also speaking on behalf of the Association of Minnesota Counties tonight. We appear in opposition to the Simpson Amendment. I was a member of the advisory group that put together or advise the department on the new rules, and I think it's fair to say that all the participants, counties, cities, as well as the industry, generally agreed on the thrust of those rules. What was unspoken but was acknowledged frequently during the course of our deliberations, that there was some need for some compensation with the adoption of the new rules that are started taking place this year and will continue over the next 2 years. I think it's obvious to every member of this committee that the loss of value, particularly for the host communities, will be substantial. From our association's point of view, the compensation for that loss of value does not necessarily have to be a class rate change. In lieu of that, we would happily get along or be willing to accept a state aid, a permanent state aid. The governor, in fact, in his recommendation, did recommend such an aid. However, he only recommended it on a temporary basis. Absent that, the class rate seems to be the only other choice, and that is what is before you at this time. I think you all have a grasp of how large the reduction is. Through the discussion you've had on the Department of Revenue analysis, you realize the significant shift, particularly in the host communities, of taxes that will incur and the increases that will occur on other homeowners and properties. The only other thing I want to bring to the committee's attention is that utility property is relatively unique in that most of its valuation is determined on what's called the income basis. And one of the largest changes that were made in the rule was taking off a cap on what's called depreciation that was used in the income approach to value. This property is relatively unique that absent improvements, its value goes down almost every year absent, again, new improvements. So these communities aren't scot-free. They face losses in value every year, but at a relatively modest level. This would obviously be a substantial change. With that, Madam Chair, I'll conclude my testimony. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Any questions for Mr. Carlson? Representative Broad.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Carlson, I'm trying to, if the class rate stays the same, then if the Simpson Amendment doesn't go forward, is there really a need for the additional aid then? Because the class rate then essentially has offset much of the loss or the perceived loss. I'm looking at the aid pieces and, you know, where that money is being spent and how, you know, with the tax situation and the budget situation, how do we best use those dollars?
Mr. Carlson.
Madam Chair, Representative Broad, if I understand you correctly, I think basically the committee is faced with a choice. If you want to protect the host communities and their other property owners, either compensate them with the class rate change as it is in this bill, which again I think has already been mentioned does not go as far as last year's bill, or provide an alternative of an ongoing state aid. It's either one or the other, or potentially a combination of both, but right now what you have before you is just compensation or partial compensation by the class rate changes.
Further?
Madam Chair, maybe I'm reading it wrong. I see both in this bill, and maybe you can help me understand. I thought I saw some aid to cities and counties for some offsets, and maybe I read it wrong.
Madam Chair, members, the aid information that you're seeing is just saying for purposes of determining local government aid, school aid, and so on, these class rate changes are taken into account essentially prospectively before it's already come through the historic data that they usually do. So it's just seeing that they're not double compensated in the normal computation of those several aid programs.
Right. Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Carlson. We have other testifiers. Mr. Ahern, did you want to join us? Are you, no? Yes, someone else, okay. Is it Jim Duval? Did I pronounce that right? Duval?
Madam Chair, my name's Rick Evans. I'm Government Affairs for XL Energy. Mr. Duval sits next to me.
Yes, thank you.
I'm here for the
Duval.
Okay. I'll let him do the talking.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Evans. Welcome.
Welcome, Madam Chair and members. My name is Jim Duvall, and I'm with the Xcel Energy Tax Department, and I thank you very much for giving me time on your agenda this evening. I'm here to speak in opposition to the utility tax rate increases found in Article 2, Section 13. Just by way of recap, this provision provides for a 40% increase in the electric generation class rate. It goes from 2% to 2.5% to 2.8% ultimately in pay 10. It also provides for a 12.5% increase in the electric and gas T&D class rate, going from 2 to 2.15 and then 2.25. Now, the purpose of these class rate increases is to maintain a revenue stream primarily for the host communities in response to the DOR rule changes, the correction and the lowering of market values. Now, Xcel Energy opposes the class rate increases for three reasons. The DOR rule changes, effective for Pay 08, prospectively correct the prior overvaluation practices. Now, despite tax overpayments in the past by utilities, the bill turns right around and increases the class rates to offset the reduced market values. To us, this in effect continues the overpayment of tax. Secondly, the class rate increases reverse 15 years of state tax policy not to expand the personal property tax, and which was phased out in other industries in the 1970s. There has not been, there has been personal property tax exemptions for all new electric plants since 1993. Lastly, and probably most importantly, we oppose the property tax class rate increases due to the significant ongoing capital investments that we're making in our plants. And as a result, our electric generation market values will never drop by 40%. Now, this is evidenced already in the first year of our new DOR rules, and we can see that by comparing our expected Pay 2008 taxes against our Pay 07 taxes at our five largest power plants. Now, when we're talking about our expected 2008 property taxes, we're really looking at our truth in taxation statements that we have, and those reflect the 20% value phase-out that are in the new DOR rules. If we start off and we look at Prairie Island, we're expecting only about a $200,000 decrease in our property tax. In Pay 2007, we paid $11.2 million, and this year in Pay 08, we're expecting to pay $11 million. That's less than a 2% reduction. If we look at Sherco, we're expecting about a $500,000 decrease. Last year, we paid about $8.5 million. This year, we expect to pay about $8 million. At Monticello, we expect no change. Last year, we paid $5.6 million. This year, we're expecting to pay the same. We look at King. There, we expect to pay $1.1 million in additional tax. Last year, we paid $1.9 million. This year, we expect to pay $3 million. And finally, for Black Dog, we expect about a $100,000 increase. Last year, we paid about $1.6 million, and this year we pay a $1.7 million. Overall, there's a net increase at our five largest plants. Again, this is due to the significant investments that we're making, and future investments are going to continue to mitigate against these value reductions. So when you step back, it begs the question, are the class rate increases really necessary given our investments? We think not. In sum, we think it's unnecessary and inappropriate to increase the utility class rate, either on generation or on T&D. We appreciate the removal from the bill. Thank you. I'd be happy to take questions.
Thank you for that, Mr. Duvall. Appreciate that. Representative Wolfire.
Mr. Duvall, I have three questions for you. Has Xcel's taxes gone up or down in the last 20 years? That's the first question. Second question is, do you consider yourself a risk in any way to the host cities? And the third question is, I've been reading your website for some time. And in the past, Excel has actually posted higher profits as a reason, giving a reduction in taxation for higher profits. Can you comment on that?
Mr. Goodell.
Madam Chair, Representative Volkswagen, your first question.
It's Volkswagen.
Well,
Volkswagen, not Volkswagen.
Pardon me.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, Representative Volkswagen, regarding your first question, has Excel taxes gone down in the last 20 years? I'm not entirely sure where they were 20 years ago. I wasn't with
the
company.
But it starts right here if you didn't get it.
But I would surmise that's the case.
Could a page bring the list of the testifier?
Regarding your second question, are we a risk to the host community?
Yeah, do you present any risk?
Do we present any risk? Certainly, if our plants were to close down, there certainly would be a loss of the revenue stream, and that would present a risk.
So, Chair, Mr. Duvall, you have absolutely no perception of a risk from the public for a nuclear power plant in a host city. You've never heard of that before?
I'm not sure I can, since I represent the tax area, I'm not sure if I can go into all of the whys and why nots of nuclear power.
Madam Chair, maybe I can take a stab at that. I mean, we certainly understand that our large industrial facilities place some burden on the communities that we're at. I don't know that we think of it so much in terms of risk as much as we certainly are. We're there and we present a burden just as any other large industrial facility in a community would. We are unique in that we are the only industrial facility that pays personal property taxes, and we're certainly not here advocating that the personal property taxes be repealed.
I think my point, Mr. Evans, is that you're the only plant I'm aware of that doesn't offer public tours, correct? You offer public tours to the representatives and special guests. But anyone who has a concern in Red Wing, for example, couldn't just go to Prairie Island and take a tour because you have safety concerns. Mr. Evans, that's my point.
Madam Chair, Representative Volkswagen, as I understand it, the accessibility of tours, which we used to give public tours, but through NRC regulations, federal regulations, we're not permitted to do that except in special circumstances, including regulators like yourself. So that's my understanding of the tour policy.
Chair, Mr. Evans, my point is that if you have citizens that have a fear, you can alleviate that.
Mr. Evans?
That's my point.
I'm sorry, that we can't alleviate that?
You can alleviate it through having a simple tour to show people how safe you are. And my third question.
Like
okay. My third question.
That's right. There was a third. I believe it was about the website. Right. Representative Volkswagen, Mr. Duvall.
Can you please repeat the question?
Well, on your website, I've read your website for some time. You post higher profits, and one of the reasons you've given is that you've been able to successfully reduce your taxes. You certainly had that on your website, and I was just asking about that because you're talking about that you haven't. You know, about your taxation, but then on the other hand, you brag on your website about being able to reduce your tax.
Mr. Evans.
Madam Chairman, Representative Volkswagen, I'm not sure exactly what you're referring to, but I think it is certainly true that we have, particularly due to some losses that we've suffered over recent years, have been able to reduce our federal income tax liability. Mm-hmm. Fairly significantly, and that may be what they're referring to, and I'm sure if that's what it says, that's correct. That's the situation I'm aware of, at least, where I know that we have had lower federal income taxes in recent years because of some rather substantial losses that we suffered.
Okay, thank you. Unless there are further questions for these two, I wanted to ask Commissioner Innes to join us at the desk. Representative Broad.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm a little confused by this chart, and maybe somebody can help me out with it, but it says taxes, and I'm trying to figure out, is that income, is it property, what's included in the word taxes?
Representative Broad.
Never that simple.
This was Excel's handout, I guess, at a previous committee hearing that Representative Marquardt chaired, and Representative Marquardt if you want to try to describe to us what somebody passed out in your committee, it's my understanding from this job, it says Excel's handout at House Tax Committee, which I have to believe took place, well, it could have been the full tax committee, but I think it was the division on April 24th. Maybe someone knows something about this.
Madam Chair, I don't remember exactly what tax this is. I can't remember.
Please. If somebody actually can know, they know where this came from. See, this is why you put the little footnotes and the dates and... No.
Madam Chair, my name is Bradley Peterson.
Yes, please join us.
With Flaherty and Hood, and we represent the Coalition of Utility Cities, which includes Red Wing, Becker, Monticello, Granite Falls, Cohasset, White Lakes, and Oak Park Heights.
Okay.
This handout, what was originally given to the committee by Xcel Energy, and I believe that it was actually in the full committee, I don't believe it was in division, is my recollection, was handed out by Xcel Energy. And what we did in a similar recess as you had today was modify it simply to show that, at least according to their own handout, whatever taxes they were speaking of, I assume the property taxes, you can see that they paid roughly the same amount of tax in 1990 as they did in 2005. This is okay. Their handout with some modifications by the Coalition of Utility Cities.
Okay, thank you for that. Can we, before we go further, can we get that available to Mr. Evans and Mr. DeVell, who are here, who I think do not have that, and we're...
We have it.
No, they have it.
Okay, you do have it. Okay. Okay, so Representative Dodd, your question on that?
Actually, I didn't have a question. I was just trying to get clarification on what it actually was. But, Madam Chair, I do have a question for Mr. Evans related to an agreement that was made with the City of Red Wing, or the County of Goodhue, and could you talk a little bit about the agreement that you have in place and maybe about the process to come to that agreement?
Madam Chair, Representative Rod, over the years...
Can I interrupt you? I'm so sorry. Okay, we've just got some little insight that maybe this will help you, Mr. DeVell, because Ms. Bergman here has found that it was Joseph Reinberger testified. He was the property and sales tax consultant for Xcel Energy on that date. And so I don't know if that solves the puzzle, but continue, Mr. Evans. So maybe someone in the audience knows more.
Madam Chair, on that point, my only question, I imagine we did. Joe Reinberger worked for Mr. DeVall, so
okay.
I imagine that that's accurate. What I don't know is whether this represents property taxes,
okay,
personal property taxes, income taxes. I don't. The numbers seem fairly large on the left-hand column, and so we'd need to find out exactly what taxes we're talking about with this. Madam Chair, Representative Broad, in response to the question, over the years leading up to the rule change, utility companies believed that they were being overtaxed. Some utility companies went to tax court, and my understanding is that they were universally successful in having the tax court rule that the Department of Revenue was misinterpreting the statute. Xcel Energy did not do that. We did not go to tax court. We talked about it a couple of times. I think we actually filed suit at one time, but we withdrew it. What we tried to do was work through the Department of Revenue and work with our host cities for our largest plants to see if we could come to some sort of an agreement without having to go to court. Ultimately, we were successful in getting the Department of Revenue to look at their rules and to make their rules consistent with the findings of the tax court. At the same time, we knew that this was going to have a substantial impact on our three largest host cities, which is where our Sherco plant is, the Monticello plant, and the Prairie Island plant down in Red Wing. What we did with those communities is approach them and offer to sign an agreement with them that for 10 years we would voluntarily make payments to equalize the result of the rule change so that they would have 10 years to get to adjust their budgets. Of course, also realizing that because of the significant improvements Mr. Duval talked about, the tax liability was our tax liability was likely to increase over that period of time. I believe at this time that the Red Wing community, where the Prairie Island plant is located, is the only one that signed the agreement. My understanding is that Monticello and Becker preferred to go through the legislative route and get the rate change, but we have agreed with Red Wing
to hold them harmless for 10 years for the result of this change, because we didn't realize it was going to be a significant impact on them.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir, Colonel Fletcher. Mr. Evans, can you also comment on the fact that it is written into that, that if this classification rate changes, of course, that voids that contract? And Red Wing is well aware of that and is willing to give it up for the greater good of all of the host cities.
Well, I can't comment on why they're willing to give it up, but certainly that's our understanding, is that we aren't going to agree to do the agreement as well as the class
rating. I'm just asking you to be complete.
Well,
your comments.
I would be happy to provide you with copies of the agreement if you'd like.
Okay, so it's very tense room, I understand that, and it's difficult to come to the tax committee under any circumstance, so I appreciate that you're testifying, and we're all just trying to get as much information as we can here. Are there other folks from the utilities who'd like to testify on this amendment? Thank you, Mr. Duvall, for your testimony. Thank you, Mr. Evans. Welcome.
Good evening, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Mike Ahern, and I'm here on behalf of another industry group that's also affected by this class rate change that you haven't heard about tonight, and that's the natural gas pipeline industry. I'm here speaking on behalf of Northern Natural Gas Pipeline, Northern Border Pipeline Company, Great Lakes Gas Transmission, and Viking Gas Transmission. I'm pinch-hitting for these companies right now due to the short time frame between introduction of this bill and this hearing. I couldn't get their tax people up here for this meeting. So you'll bear with me, if you will, because I'm not the expert. These companies have asked me to voice their strong opposition to this class rate increase that's contained in this bill. You may recall last year when the natural gas pipeline testified against the inherent unfairness of this proposal generally, and most specifically as it applied to the pipeline, the natural gas pipeline. Last year, the rationale behind this bill, as we've heard tonight, was to make whole the taxing districts that were fearing a decrease in the tax revenue resulting from the implementation of the new Department of Revenue rule. I think as all have acknowledged, the effect of the new Department of Revenue rules was to correct a systemic overvaluation that was built into those rules and a resulting overtaxation of the utility and pipeline properties that had been perpetuated under the old rules. So in last year, the rules finally were changed and implemented to appropriately value the tax both the utilities and the pipelines, which resulted in, on a going-forward basis, fair and some would argue overdue prospective tax reductions for many of the entities in this class, that was appropriate. However, for the rather than issue refunds for past overpayments, or at least an extended apology for years of overtaxation of these taxpayers, this bill, and it's the legislature's prerogative, chose to just raise the rate and put an increase on top of these tax entities. As unfair, at least from the pipeline company's perspective, as this rationale is, it does not even apply to the natural gas pipeline group. Last year, you may recall, the Department of Revenue appeared before the subcommittee, and I don't remember if it was the full committee, and indicated that their analysis showed that the natural gas pipeline as a group were likely to get a slight increase under the new rule. Therefore, any new increase in class rate on top of that is just a straight windfall to those local taxing districts, because it's a tax increase on top of the tax increase imposed by the new valuation rule. This past fall, the Department of Revenue had a meeting to kind of explain where things were and the effects of the rule, as well as looking at the vetoed tax bill. And I'll just show you one item that came out of that analysis. An analysis was done of what happens under the I'll read to you because you aren't going to be able to see it. The estimated impact of the new rule and vetoed tax bill as a percentage of the next the net tax capacity. And it assumes 100% phase-in. You can see on this it's a color map, and the bright green lines you see dissecting the state, those are the pipelines that, according to the chart here, will be the taxing districts will be getting a 3% to 20% increase as a result of this proposed tax increase. That would be slightly modified due to the number that was changed here. But I think it shows in rather graphic form that, at least as applied to the natural gas pipeline, this is a windfall for the local taxing jurisdictions. And the rationale that might apply to Red Wing or Becker simply doesn't apply to this entire other industry group that's affected by this fact.
Thank you for that, Mr. Ahern. Excuse me, and I agree that there's different effects going on here on different industries, so I appreciate your testimony on that. Questions for Mr. Ahern? Other testifiers on the Simpson Amendment? From anyone? Commissioner Ines, can you join us? I'd like to hear your thoughts on the Simpson Amendment.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ward Ines, representing the Department of Revenue. And I guess I'm going to start with this. I mean, Madam Chair, you and I had conversations last week about fast-tracking a tax bill early in session, hopefully getting it enacted before March 1st, maximize the amount of federal conformity we can achieve in that time frame. I took that to mean a very non-controversial, agreed-upon bill that didn't have any of the controversy that this provision has. And to revisit the veto message the governor drafted last year, when that bill came to his desk, there were numerous provisions in the bill that were less than optimum from our perspective. But we chose to be very strategic and only highlight four in the veto message. And we understand that in an omnibus bill of that magnitude, you don't get everything you want. We highlighted the four issues that were the most problematic from the governor's perspective. And to refresh your memory, those issues were the inflation provision. They were the Mall of America. They were the distribution of the property tax. The governor thought it was too heavily weighted towards local government aid. And then fourthly, the class rate increase on utility property. Those were the four issues we limited our veto message to. And so I think this is the inappropriate vehicle for an issue of that magnitude that was specifically referenced in the governor's veto message. And I know that Madam Chair has referenced conversations we had in July and August. Those conversations and discussions, I would call them preliminary and tentative negotiations, were in the context of negotiating a much larger global macro deal that included JobZ and FLCs and, you know, dairy investment tax credits and a whole number of issues that aren't before us today in this committee. So I think it's a little bit disingenuous, actually, to try to insert that issue into a bill that's really meant to be fast-tracked and be passed in a very short time frame. And so if there was any miscommunication in the course of July and August negotiations, I apologize, but I was never under the impression that we had reached an agreement on this issue on the utility class rate. We had discussions. I'd even mentioned that if, in fact, there was a class rate solution at the end of the day, the class rates that were in the bill in the veto bill were too high. And that was, I opened the door at that point to further discussion on what we could do to kind of bridge the difference. But to say that this reached the level of final agreement in the context of that very much larger, global, 300-page, controversial tax bill, and then say, well, we had an agreement, let's tack it onto this bill, I just don't think that's an accurate representation.
Okay, Commissioner Ines, let me address that, and we've got a little list here for you, so don't go anywhere. Of people who want to address your testimony. First, I want to ask you, will the governor veto the tax bill with this provision in? Will he veto this tax bill?
Madam Chair, I haven't had a discussion with the governor regarding the bill that's before you today or this provision specifically since we drafted this letter, really. And maybe We may have talked in July and August about this provision. The fact that he thought it warranted being referenced in the veto letter would tell me that including this in any tax bill would potentially jeopardize the bill.
Okay, so the whole bill here now with, 100 member bills or whatever, in conformity, very important to the Department of Revenue. Besides this provision, do you think in general the governor's okay with his bill? Could you opine?
Yeah, speculate.
Go ahead.
I would
not on the tape.
I would
turn it off for a second.
Madam Chair, the only issue at this point that causes me pause is the utility class.
Okay.
The remainder of the bill, I think it's a fair representation of items that have been agreed upon. Really don't rise to a first tier, level of concern. This one does. The fact that it was one of only four issues that he took the time to mention in his veto message, I think would cause me a lot of concern if that was included.
Okay. And my last, before we go to others, I want you to know I'm going to vote. Even I don't know if we'll get the roll call or not, but I want you to know so you're not guessing when you're listening. I am going to oppose the Simpson Amendment. I'm going to support Representative Wolfhager here today on this, but I want to tell you and to tell the whole committee that I think everyone's got a legitimate point here, and I want you to know that, very clearly that Senator Bach and I did not think this would be this problem that we've got before us here tonight. And so for folks who are hearing you and I talk about July and August, members should know that as we were preparing for special session, there was an attempt by Commissioner Innes and I and Senator Bach to repass the tax bill. And we were working through the provisions on the vetoed tax bill, and then other bills were being introduced. At that time, I felt, and Senator Bach, and I think Commissioner Innes is saying he felt something differently, and that happens when y'all try to negotiate and you hear different things, we felt we had an agreement. As Senator Bach and I walked through the provisions, the letters, all the things that made it a governor's desk that didn't cost money because, we don't have money now, that he didn't cite or that we could agree upon, we put it in, believing that we had kind of gotten there and this could work. This was certainly not Representative Wolfhager's ideal bill. In fact, we'd like something more than this. And, in fact, that's what we had carried in the House tech bill, as you know. So I wanted people to understand that I don't think that Commissioner Innes is being disingenuous, and I hope you don't think I am either, because Senator Bach and I felt this was something, we felt we actually got the number from the executive branch. The 2.8 actually came from the executive branch, not from the House or Senate, and that was in the context of a different day and a different bill. And so I want to put that on the record, but I do want to support Representative Wolfhager here today in opposing this amendment, and I just I don't want us to start off the session, pointing fingers at each other, because that won't be a successful session, and we do want to get this bill signed. But I think there is opportunity for more conversation going forward, and I know that Representative Hillstrom and Representative Wolfhager have comments for you as well. But did you want to respond to my laying it out there, kind of?
I don't want
you to think we're trying to play a trick.
No,
we don't
care. We had a lot of discussions in the course of the summer, and we broached a lot of issues. I took those as really tentative negotiations in the context of a very different bill than we have before us today. July and August are a long time ago. Things have changed. We have a different situation here. I mean, if we were going to look at what we had stipulated to in July and August, I mean, Job Z should be in front of us. All three of us had clearly agreed that the Job Z extension was not a problem, had been concurred to by all three of us, but that's not before us today, and I don't think it would be appropriate for me to try to say it should be before us today. I think that's an issue for a different time, for a different bill, for maybe the end of session tax bill, and I think this falls in that same category.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am not confident that there will be an end of session tax bill. Others in the room may think that there is one, but I think that this is our one shot. And as the chair of the local government committee, I am very concerned to find out that host cities are being placed in a very, very difficult position here. If this isn't the solution, given the fact that we may not have a second chance at it, what are you proposing that would be the solution to fix this problem? Because I am not prepared to leave here today and leave these host cities hanging out there to dry.
Right.
That's right.
Madam Chair, Representative Hillstrom, last year's budget we did propose temporary transition aid. I know it wasn't the optimum solution from the host communities, but it was an acknowledgement that we knew this issue needed to be addressed in some way. I'm not sure what will be included in supplemental budget. We're still, it's a work in progress, but some sort of transition aid is certainly being considered. You know, at this point, I just don't know. I think I'm more optimistic than you are, Representative. I think there's still an opportunity to do a more global tax bill. There's a lot of issues we left on the table last year that I think I would all agree need to be revisited. So, you know, the department and the administration will work hard to get a package together. And we have things we really want, you know, and I'm sure a lot of people on this table have things they want. So I think, I'm hoping reason will prevail and we'll be able to revisit this issue and hopefully reach an agreement that will be acceptable to all the parties. It's a long session yet.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, because I'm not confident that there would be a second tax bill, I think it might be a good idea to put this provision in the event there is a second tax bill, we can work out any negotiated agreement to fix this problem in the future.
Representative Wolfwalker, then Representative Dellert. Representative Wolfwalker.
Okay, Chair members, Commissioner Ines. On Monday, the Democrats pulled the indexing out of the transportation bill. Now, again, I've said this 100 times. I'm a freshman. I haven't been around the block 100 times here. I was told that we did that to appease some concerns. And what happened? The Minnesota Chamber of Commerce and the Minnesota Business Partnership promptly trotted up and said, you know what? There's something else we don't like. And, you know, that just happened this week. So my trust is pretty low, Mr. Ines. And so I see the same pattern on this. And you got a letter from the governor, right, from me, but it probably, on another day, could have had four other items, because that's kind of the pattern we've seen from the governor, too, is that if he doesn't want to do something, he comes up with excuse after excuse after excuse. So my trust is low. I'm with Representative Hillstrom on this. I don't see us working out a second tax bill, and I just want to get over this and move on.
Representative Dellert, it's getting pretty grim about that next tax bill. Anybody else have any amendments? Representative
Dellert. As a matter of fact, I'm sure I will be next on amendments. But Commissioner Ines, the one section that I'd actually disagree with you on is, and I apologize for missing the discussion on the non-deductibility. I just had to watch the graduation of a first snowplower into a second snowplower in skating. So we've got a graduate now. The non-deductibility, as far as I've been able to research the last two or three days now, was not before this committee, was not before a Senate committee, and has not been for a couple of years. And if the research again is right, and I believe Joel talked about this, we're going the opposite way of federal conformity on this, and I would consider that, especially if it's not been heard before, and at least my recollection is, that's something that's new and unique, and again, we're talking about messing with long-term settlements that, you know, some companies are counting on deducting over time that are now going to be open to all kinds of renegotiations or contractors getting, you name it. This could end up in the courts, which I guess if you're in the lawyering business, that's good for them, but not necessarily good for the state.
Cliff Reines.
Madam Chair, Representative Zeller, your point is well taken. However, that provision was surely vetted within the context of the conference committee. We did talk about it. The department did not take a position on it. We were neutral on that provision. There are numerous provisions in the bill before you today that I don't think are ideal. And if I was drafting the bill and putting it together, they wouldn't do it. I understand the need to fast track it and accept some provisions that maybe are less than optimal, that wouldn't be in any text I drafted. But that's the nature of compromise. And I just think this one regarding the utility class rate is a different strike than that. This is I respectfully disagree, Representative Longshire, on the governor's letter would have been substantially different if he had written it on a different day. We thoroughly vetted that tax bill after much going back and forth of what should be included. These were the four that rose to the top that he thought were really serious deficiencies in the bill. And so there were other ones that we just decided, you know what, every omnibus bill has a few things that you don't think are optimum, and we accepted those. These are the four that I think he really had strong feelings about.
Well, and to that, I'm just trying to make the point
that
it was
changed.
But the provision we're talking about is not the same provision as what was in the May bill. I just want to make that point. It's a lower quantity.
Further questions for Commissioner Ines? Anyone else from the public would like to testify? We're going to get to a vote here. Rep. Van Broad.
Madam Chair, Commissioner Ines, do you support the, you were here earlier today, and you support the conformity bill that we did already pass out of this body, is that correct?
I do.
Madam Chair, and I guess my comment to you then is that there's no reason to have conformity bogged down in controversy. And the conformity bill that you passed out earlier was, I think, even though I didn't like a couple of provisions, I think truly could be deemed to be non-controversial and able to move forward. And so when the suggestion is made that would the governor veto this bill, this conformity bill, on this basis, there's no need to go there if we truly want conformity. There's already bills that can go that direction that we know the governor supports, Commissioner Ines supports, who came here and testified. So there's no reason to hold conformity hostage to controversy. And so I just wanted to make that point.
I absolutely agree with Representative Broad. There is no reason to hold conformity hostage for anything. So I agree with you. We want to get that conformity done. That's the most important thing. But we're here now. We're on the Simpson Amendment. We're going to take a vote on that. Anybody else? Pardon me?
All in favor?
Representative Simpson.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, Representative Wolfschlager, I appreciate your passion. I do believe the former representative from Red Wing happened to be a Republican, and I think you probably had as much passion for Red Wing as you do. So I didn't know that this was a Republican or a Democratic provision. So I want to get that clarified immediately. This is a provision, I think, that was put in place that when Representative Lenchefsky asked me to sign onto this bill, we talked about a non-controversial bill that was good tax policy, things that we needed to see done, and I agreed to do that. I saw this bill late last night, the first I've seen it, and when this item came to the top of the surface, I go right back to the governor's veto, and I say, why are we wasting our time? We had a tax bill that we spent hours and hours and hours on last year, and it was vetoed over four items. And here we are, 2 weeks into the session, we're coming through a tax conformity. There's a lot of things in here that our communities are asking for and wanting. So I felt the thing I should do was do what I did and put in a way to delete this problem so we could pass this bill. And no disrespect, but I think that doing this is the right thing to do, and I'd appreciate your support. Thank you.
Okay. All those for the discussion, all those in favor of the Simpson Amendment say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay.
No.
The amendment is not adopted. Are there further amendments? Further amendments? If not, we're going to take... Yes? Representative Zellers.
Yes.
Oh. Yes, Representative Zellers has an amendment. Apologize for that, and if someone can... I think they're working on it. You want to tell us kind of what
sure.
you're doing?
Madam Chair, it's just back to my original question about the deductibility. I'd like to delete the section. I just wanted to make sure that Joel...
Okay, so this was the question that Representative Broad raised for Representative Zellers when he was not here, and we had a little discussion, and we kind of just had a little reprise, so I think we all know what that is. So if we can just get...
Sure, while they're looking for that,
sure.
Can I make an announcement?
Yes.
We made a decision this afternoon in consultation with you and your staff to not make the staff work real late to get all these amendments and into the... the 4-hour rule before the House. And so this will probably be scheduled in Ways and Means Friday. I think it's at 9 or 9:30, one of those two. So the two tax bills will be before Ways and Means on Friday. We had it tentatively scheduled. I've had a conversation with my lead Republican Representative Fulbert on that issue already. And if these become available for us, we'll have it on Friday.
Okay. Thank you for that. And while they're working on it, they're working. I do want to thank Representative Simpson and Representative Marquardt and Representative Dabney and Representative Carlson, who way back when actually comp-read this bill for a very long time, And again, these provisions, other than conformity, came out of that process. And, you know, it reminds me, looking at the veto letter to Mr. Innes, it did take the governor a long time to veto the bill, though, May 30th. That's right. He had all those extra days. So I do want to thank the conferees who actually worked on all the bills that are in here. And are we ready with the final amendment?
Yeah.
Or is there another amendment?
Okay. Amendment, sir.
Rep. Gonzalez.
I'm not sure if we're ready. The oral amendment is on page 48, delete section 2. Page 53, delete section 5. And then in Lanchester A1 amendment, because that was added in, was adopted, page 1, delete section 4. And again, just for explanation purposes, Madam Chair, this is the non-deductibility. And again, it, many times we discussed in here talking about setting up Minnesota companies, Minnesota businesses as an island with surrounding states. And with this provision, we're going to have folks who are deducting their any of their, you know, fees, fines, settlement penalties on the federal side. Then when they get to Minnesota, they're going to have to add it back in.
No.
And with the tax climate, with the business climate, with the economy flipping, sagging, tripping, whatever it may be, I don't want to set Minnesota up not only to be yet another dodge, but now we're going to have to go back in and make extra special arrangements for any of the fees, fines, penalties. And the one question I didn't get to ask, and maybe Mr. Michael can help me with this, one of the biggest settlements that we've got is when it comes to the tobacco settlement. That's a severely long scheduled payback or payout, and I'm just wondering what that would do to some of the penalties that are scheduled, you know, for years in advance.
Mr. Michael.
Madam Chair, Representative Bellers, I have not carefully read this with an eye to making a judgment about whether or not how it would apply in that kind of circumstance. There, as I said in response to Representative Broad's question, I think there are some interpretive issues with regard to this language that I'm not sure how they would be resolved. It's been around a long time, as I indicated before. The Department of the Senate has had this provision several times. The Department of Revenue estimating staff, I think, has judged that the effect would be very small. But I think you raised a valid point that, you know, there's a little bit of lack of clarity as to exactly what it would apply to. I think in some circumstances there are a number of these settlements where there, you know, payments are made and no admission of liability, that sort of thing, and the facts and circumstances may determine whether or not this would impact those. So, but I guess the professionals at the Department of Revenue who have estimated this apparently judge that it would not affect, you know, those large payments. But
Rep. Gonzalez, I am going to oppose your amendment, but I think there's a good issue you're raising, and we can get more information as we go forward with it. The members should know that if the amendment goes on, the bill is out of balance. So there is a revenue component to it. So Rep. Solberg, he may not hear it, and he may not hear it. So I think Ms. Templin says it's about $260,000, I believe. So we'd be to the minus. So, but I appreciate the issue. Sure. Further discussion on the Zeller's amendment. Rep. Zeller.
Sure, Madam Chair. The problem I would raise with this is if a business in a state is brought in for review, or they're going to be, say they hired an illegal worker and they're being prosecuted for not due diligence, they go through, they're found by, you know, by a judge, by a court to be not guilty. The way I understand the provision, they would then not be able to even deduct that, even though they were found to not have, you know, done any harm, or not been found guilty, they would be able to deduct that either. So we're going to, you know, not only take them to court, make them pay all those legal fees, and they're not even be able to deduct it going forward after that. And again, Madam Chair, I appreciate this and the long discussion about whether or not we're balancing books with, you know, fees and penalties that we've previously told people it's okay to deduct. That's a much longer discussion that we won't go into here tonight, but that would be a grave concern to me as well, that we're balancing our books on by going back on our word, which
is never a good idea when it comes to tax policies or penalties or fees when we agreed in a courtroom that this is what we would pay, this is your fine, this is what you pay, you may deduct it. And I just think that's a bad way to do business, but I appreciate your gentle opposition, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Further discussion? Okay, all those in favor of the Zeller's oral amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, say nay.
No.
The amendment is not adopted. Further amendments? If not, we're going to call for the vote on the whole House File 3200. All those in favor, on the whole House File 3201, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say nay. The bill is passed and sent off to Ways and Means. Thank you. We're adjourned.